You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Hey, this episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Sunset Lake CBD. You can find their products at sunsetlakecbd.com. They are located in Alberg, Vermont. It's just outside of Burlington. They used to supply, they still do. It's a dairy farm that supplies milk to Ben & Jerry's. They decided to diversify, started growing hemp a couple years ago. It's a great company. They're mostly employee-owned, $15 minimum wage. They're already there, despite what their parliamentarian said on the farm, apparently.
Even better, they don't have a parliamentarian on the farm.
They got rid of their parliamentarian. They also got rid of pesticides. They're 100% pesticide-free. They only use organic fertilizers. You can go onto their website, see third-party test results for all their products. Gives you the breakdown of everything that's in there. It's sunsetlakecbd.com. Their products are fantastic. They just came out with, which I must warn you, is a little bit dangerous if you have a sweet tooth, CBD infused fudge.
Had that two nights ago.
It's really, really good, right?
I slept a lot better than I did last night when I didn't have that fudge.
It also impacts you. I mean, it impacts you more dramatically, I find, when you eat it. But I also am a big fan of the tincture. I use that as a sleep aid. Sometimes when the kids are just driving me nuts, I may also use it to just mellow out a little bit. Matt is a big fan of their smalls, which apparently you can grind up, smoke with other things that you smoke. I've smoked their pre-rolls. In fact, I think they have a sale on pre-rolls right now because they're coming out with some other strains. So you can check that out at Sunset Lake CBD. They also have gummy bears. They have CBD-infused coffee, which is my weekend brew. You will not be disappointed. And I have to say that, I mean, myself, Matt in particular, I don't know about you, Emma, but CBD skeptics, and I'm enjoying the product. And, of course, the salve, which ostensibly is with Arnica, is for muscle fatigue. I use it for my eczema. So check it out, sunsetlakecbd.com. If you use their coupon code, fans of the show, so they decided on left is best, one word, left is best, 20% off. Left is best at sunsetlakecbd.com, 20% off. Now, let us start the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day Casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday. Tuesday, Casual Tuesday. Wednesday, Casual Hump Day. Thursday, Casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, February 26, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, staff writer at The New Republic, Alex Perrine, will be joining us. Then later in the program, Matthew Film Guy. Maybe help us review some of the films that we have from CPAC. Also on the program today, President, Senate parliamentarian, says the minimum wage can't be in the reconciliation bill. And as pressure mounts on the White House, Vice President Harris to overrule that same parliamentarian's advisory opinion, Senate Democrats plot a plan B to include that minimum wage in that reconciliation. Meanwhile, U.S. bombs Syria ostensibly to teach Iran a lesson. Yes. Absurd. House Democrats pass the Equality Act. And conservatives bemoan a toy becoming gender neutral. The FCC approves a $50 monthly high-speed subsidy. And in a stunning yet completely unsurprising reversal, Mitch McConnell's Never Trump days lasted less than 2 weeks. Speaking of Trump, a Trump-appointed judge rules the CDC eviction moratorium unconstitutional, says renting is not an economic activity. Yeah, who knew? Another Trump judge sabotaging Biden's attempts to slow down deportations. And lastly, Capitol Police warned of right-wing extremist chatter about an attack during Biden's first joint address. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us today. Joining me, as always, is Emma Vigeland. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
What?
Fonzie.
Oh, you're wearing your Fonzie jacket. Oh, I see what's going on. That was, I should tell you that that's not the way that Fonzie did it. He didn't, it wasn't like he was trying some pasta or something.
Your reaction was not
how Fonzie did it. But I understand that you probably, you know, that, wow, that was not, that was not it. Well, it's Casual Friday, folks. I mean, so, you can get, that's, that is, oh boy. We can have, we should have you run through all of the sort of, I guess you would call them now, memes. We didn't call it at the time, but you should run through all the memes of all the 70s shows that that you think I miss. Yeah,
I did grow up watching I Love Lucy, but that's before your time.
Well, not too much before my time, but they certainly repeated it a lot when I was a kid. Speaking of repeats, let's get right into this. The Biden administration, and we're obviously going to be talking a lot about the $15 minimum wage, the reconciliation. What we're hearing ostensibly as to why this the $15 minimum wage can't work, et cetera, et cetera. Right? I mean, this is what we're going to be hearing. Over and over again. And we'll talk about that. But first, we should just touch on Joe Biden's maiden, I guess, bombing. and it is so, and performative and rote, and it's sad. It almost feels like it is, you know, there's going to be a joint session of Congress that you have in February that is traditional for the president when they come in. It's not, I don't know if it's quite a State of Union because he hasn't been around for a year. And this feels like the same thing, except for you end up killing, depending on which reports you believe, 1 or 17 people. And they're as far as we know at this point, all military personnel on a base in Syria. And let's just play this. This clip is from Alyssa Slotkin. Is that who it is?
Elise Slotkin, I think.
Yeah, Elise Slotkin, Michigan Democrat.
All right, let's listen to this. She's from the 8th Congressional District in Michigan. And she is the, I don't know, how would you refer to her? She's like the former CIA analyst, sort of the, a more militaristic squad, if you will.
Yeah,
right?
One of the most conservative Democrats in the House, and she's taken up that mantle. She was trying to discipline AOC and the left after the House Democrats lost some seats in this past election. That's kind of her MO.
She's part of the group called the Badasses.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I was looking for that. It's the
awesome.
The Badasses. Right.
Cool.
Well, I think it sends a pretty clear message that, you know, they attacked us. They hit and killed an American contractor, wounded American soldiers on one of our bases, and we're going to take a proportionate response, that we're going to respond. And we hit back at them, and I think it's just sort of resetting expectations that if you hit at us, we're going to punch back.
Now, there's a couple of points about this. She's talking about an attack that happened in Ibril, and make no mistake about it, this attack in Ibril, I think there's very little question as to whether or not it was a war crime. I don't know if you can say if there was 17 people killed in this response, how it's proportionate as hitting back. We should also say that the attacks on these people are these bases were bases that have basically been attacking members of ISIS or ISIL, as we now refer to them. This is ostensibly to show Iran that we can't be pushed around, as there is an attempt to get back into the nuclear deal that we, as a country, walked away from after negotiating and having it settled.
And a reminder that Iran, the only reason that we haven't tumbled into war with Iran has been based on Iran's own restraint. I mean, after the assassination of one of their top military officials, Soleimani, by Trump, they retaliated in a way that was obviously an attempt to appear like they were retaliating, but without escalating towards war with Trump. And so now that Biden has entered back into office, they're doing kind of these same performative tactics, but it's not just performative and there's zero consequences. Potentially 17 people died here. It's like sacrificial lambs in order to appear strong. Newsflash, Iran's already aware that the United States has significant military capabilities, more than any country on earth, by multiple factors. They don't need to see a show of force in order to be afraid of the United States in negotiations. The fact that the Iran deal was so tilted towards the U.S. was indicative of that.
Lastly, here's an idea. We have no interests in Syria at this point. Let's get our 1,000 troops out of Syria. We no longer are wanted in Iraq. Let's get our troops from Iraq. Reminder, the Iraqi parliament voted for the U.S. to withdraw in February 2020.
We've ignored that.
We have still 2,500 troops in Iraq. That is where the attack took place, up in Iraqi Kurdistan. Why don't we get our troops out so that we don't have to engage in these type of ridiculous exercises that end up killing people, just to show that, you know, we're tough. Here's an idea. Let's just not be there. Our interests are not there. NATO can handle anything that arises in Iraq. Maybe it's time that we just pack up and leave.
Well, this is Joe Biden's mantra. Nothing will fundamentally change. This is status quo foreign policy for the United States, unfortunately, and it's sociopathic. The amount that our elected officials, or I guess the administration, has removed from the murder of people cognitively, it's disturbing to me when you read these kinds of things.
And lastly, we need to work out a system where the attacking, engaging in a bombing of another country is harder to do than raising the minimum wage after decades with a majority of both houses. We need to figure out a system that works a little bit better for that. Now, Tim Kaine, to his credit, is for the third president in a row requesting, you know, how this is justified and by the president. I mean, you're not supposed to wage war. And I know this is just kinetic activity that involves bombing and killing people, but our constitutional system is such that you're not supposed to wage war without congressional authority. So maybe we need congressional authority to actually to bomb other countries. And maybe also we should get congressional authority to raise the minimum wage, as opposed to, you know, waiting on the parliamentarian or some arcane rule about 60 votes. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Alex Parikh. Brendan just sent me an IM that I don't understand.
What? What did he say?
Just, it's called Perrine, not by Alex, but we'll find out what the deal is. Folks, well, I'll save Emma's favorite ad for a second.
I'm afraid.
This has actually been, arguably helpful for me. I don't know. I feel a little bit calmer, but maybe not.
I think you are.
Yeah, it's possible. Wouldn't it be great if there were a pocket-sized guide that helped you sleep, focus, act, and just be better? Well, there is. And if you got 10 minutes, Headspace can change your life. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness, and it comes in the form of guided meditations. It comes on an app, super easy to use. It's advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. There are over 25 published studies on Headspace's benefits. 600,000 five-star reviews and over 60 million downloads. Headspace can help you reduce stress, can help you improve your sleep, boost your focus, and just basically make you feel better in general. The Headspace has wind-down sessions, 3-minute SOS meditations that can help you if you're having trouble sleeping or if you're feeling a little overwhelmed. There are meditations for kids. And Headspace works on your schedule. You can use it anytime you want, whatever. And they have, for me, the big one is, because I'm not, I have trouble. I have trouble being whatever it is you need to do.
Present.
Be mindful. Present. Yes. I have trouble being present.
As do I.
And, but they have a walking guided meditation.
Nice.
And that's helpful to me because I do a lot of walking. I mean, I don't do a lot of walking, but I do a decent amount of walking. And it's very hard for me to justify sitting and doing and just focusing on like calming down or being mindful for any period of time, like even 60 seconds if I'm not doing something. So when I'm doing a walking, I feel like I'm dual purposing stuff. So that's what I like about that. But you can get their 1 month free trial. And check it out for yourself. Look, you deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation that is made simple. Go to headspace.com/majority. That's headspace.com/majority for a free 1 month trial. You get access to Headspace full library meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/majority today. And these things are great. And I literally just ordered more. Most healthy snacks, they don't taste very good, they don't fill you up, and they don't satisfy your cravings. Well, this episode is sponsored by Monk Pack, and they make snacks that taste like your favorite sugary treats, but with 1 gram or sugar or less. You guys know that I'm big, largely because of my sister, but just in general, insisting on cutting down on sugar, and I won't give it to my kids. Monk Pack Keto Nut and Seed Bars contain 2 to 3 grams of net carbs. They're only 150 calories, and they come in delicious flavors. Sea salt, dark chocolate, right? Caramel sea salt and peanut butter, dark chocolate. They're delicious. And more. They got the maple pecan. They're keto friendly. They're gluten-free. They're plant-based. They're non-GMO. They're basically like what we call granola bars or whatever it was, but they're delicious, but they only 150 calories and virtually no sugar and 2 to 3 net grams of carbs. This is stuff that not only my kids love, but I can feel good about giving it to them. And obviously, I mean, if you have kids, you know how crucial it is. You got to take a bunch of these type of bars wherever you go because they're constantly hungry, and you've got to keep feeding them. And to feed them nut and seed bars that are not high in sugar, bam, Boom. Game over. Try it for yourself. You'll see. We have a special deal for our listeners. You get 20% off your first purchase of any Monk Pack product by visiting monkpack.com and entering our code MajorityReport at checkout. Monk Pack's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't like it for any reason, they'll exchange the product or refund your money, whichever you prefer. To get started, just go to monkpack.com. That's monkpack, M-U-N-K, pack, P-A-C-K, .com, and select any product. Then enter the code MajorityReport at checkout. Save 20% off your purchase. Monkpack, delicious, nutritious food you can count on. Thank them for sponsoring the podcast, and thank you for giving my kids a snack that I don't feel like I'm a bad person or a bad parent for giving them. And lastly, I saved this for Emma. As you know, new rear, new you, right? In 2021, don't just make a commitment to wash your hands every time you go. Go the extra mile, wash your butt. I tell my kids that all the time. brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment is finally here. It's stylish, it's eco-friendly, easy to install, and super affordable. Look, Hello Tushy 3.0, it doesn't just cleanse your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself. It cleans it before and after it's used with the Smart Spray automatic self-cleaning nozzle. It's super easy. It attaches to your existing toilet. It doesn't require any electricity, doesn't require any additional plumbing, cuts toilet paper use by 80%. So the Hello Tushy bidet pays for itself in a few months. With Hello Tushy, you don't wipe at all. You just poop, you spray, you dry, and you go. Sanitation simple. The Schmutz Shield offers cleaning, easy cleaning, and the knobs are naturally antimicrobial. Plus, every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee, a 12-month warranty. You can upgrade to the 3.0 model if you're already hooked on Hello Tushy. And I've got the classic. I'm going to make the move for the 3.0. It's super easy to install this. I've told this story before, but early in the pandemic, Kyle was like, "We got a bidet. It's changed my life." And I'm like, we've been talking to Hello Tushy. I should go for it. Because I've always wondered. And now I know. Folks, believe me, once you go bidet, you don't
go bidak.
Go bidak. Thank you. Go to hellotushy.com/majority. Get 10% off with free shipping, plus free shipping. A special offer for our listeners. Go to hellotushy, TUSHY.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. You will thank me. Brenda just came up with, once you go bidet, there ain't no other way.
Yeah, it was better than, you know, I came up with mine on the fly, so
yeah.
Kind of better than Brendan, funnier in general.
Let's bring in Alex Preen. He is staff writer for The New Republic, also the host or co-host of their podcast, The Politics of Everything. Alex, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
You got a new setup. You got a new microphone. Looking good.
Setup.
Thank you.
Well timed. I want to talk about. You wrote a piece about Limbaugh the other day. Maybe it was last week. I want to talk about that because I found that really interesting. Obviously, and Rush Limbaugh. I've been listening to him for what was left of his life and really the early 90s. But before we get that, you've been writing also for a while about, Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin. And we are now at the point that we have been sort of waiting for. And that is the parliamentarian has provided her advisory opinion about the validity of putting the $15 minimum wage into the reconciliation bill. We hear a lot of the sort of mainstream commentators saying, "Oh, I knew it wasn't going to happen the whole time. And this is obvious." And I mean, what's stunning to me is that the way this is being framed now, it's fascinating. I mean, I don't think there's been attempts to be, but there's no There's no one who makes the case that Kamala Harris cannot overrule the advice of the parliamentarian, and then it takes 60 votes to overrule her opinion.
Right. Right.
Who's arguing that? It's just that, like, we're not going to do it ostensibly, I guess, for institutional reasons. But if you're worried about the institution of the Senate and the parliamentarian, well, then you should be actively pursuing getting rid of the filibuster, right? I mean, right. Well, you can't really hold both those ideas in your hand at the same time. And, you know, I don't know why anybody who's not involved with the Senate is an institutionalist about the Senate. So I'm not talking about commentators. I'm talking about those people who, you know, I'm talking about Joe Manchin.
Right. I think a lot of senators and a lot of people in politics, or a lot of people in government, I mean, have a sort of misunderstanding of what it means to want to protect the institution of the Senate. And I think that they always tend to think that means doing what individual senators want and not about protecting the legitimacy of the institution. And if it's run in this insane, arcane way where incredibly popular things can't happen for reasons that make no sense, that's not good for the legitimacy of the institution of the Senate. It doesn't actually advance. Like, it just makes people think that this is just a joke and that no one in the Senate actually cares about what happens. So I think it's a misunderstanding that has already, in my mind, damaged the legitimacy of the Senate. I have very little respect for it as an institution myself.
Brian Deese, he is the the White House National Economic Council director, has said, has weighed in. This is after Ron Klain, the chief of staff, said this the other night on MSNBC. The vice president is not going to weigh in. We'll respect that process. Well, but I see, this is what I think is so aggravating for people who actually care about the $15 minimum wage or any policy for that matter. The process includes the ability of the vice president. I mean, the fact that I can articulate it suggests that I'm not making it up. This is a process. That is part of the process, too. And so what they're trying to do here is, it seems like, is say, we're making a choice, but we want to pretend like we're not making a choice.
Exactly. They want to pretend it's completely outside of their hands. And it is. You are completely right, too. This is the silly thing about all this, is that the parliamentarian is a job that was invented in the 1930s. The vice president is the president of the Senate. Like, that's actually – so there I think that the institutional claim is that, like, oh, the senators will revolt if we intrude on their precious process. But it's like that's the vice president's job. The vice president's job is to preside over the Senate. Just because they stopped doing that 150 years ago doesn't mean that's not, like, how it's written down.
Right.
Yeah, well, this is what we're going to see from Biden throughout his presidency, is hiding behind process. And I think that's the theme, or hiding behind procedure at the very least. Because, I mean, there's no excuse to not overrule the parliamentarian, except for the fact that they don't – the best interpretation from Biden's perspective is that they genuinely feel like Manchin and Sinema are going to hold up the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill because of the $15 minimum wage, because they've said that they're opposed to it. I think that that's a false premise, because there's just no way that once that bill is in front of them and Manchin and Sinema are forced to make that choice, especially Manchin. I mean, West Virginia is the sixth poorest state in the country, and Sinema, I mean, I just don't see her making that decision. I doubt that they would vote no and vote against the rest of their party on the stimulus package. So I think he's hiding behind two things, hiding behind Manchin and Sinema, who I don't think are as solid in their opposition as the White House is pretending they are, and then also behind procedure, which is just like in the midterms, that's not going to fly. Oh, the parliamentarian said we couldn't raise the minimum wage, so
you've written about that with Manchin and Sinema, right? The idea that, like, it's one thing to say I'm against the $15 minimum wage, it's another to say, like, I'm prepared to tank the entire $1.9 trillion bill for that.
And I think that they want it to be protected from having to make that decision, and the parliamentarian gives them an excuse. But it's, you know, I mean, the minimum wage is almost certainly more popular than either of them in their home states. I think that they should have been forced to actually take that vote. Here I am saying force the vote, but there you go. I think Emma's completely right. And I think they wanted to, there's a reason that they announced their opposition to it, which is that they wanted it taken out of the bill before they had to vote on it. Cause I don't think they would have taken that step.
That's right. I mean, that's the bottom line is that they can announce their opposition to it. And at the end, you know, I think to a large extent, and I think you've made this case over the past couple of months, that the real concern, you know, for Sinema and Manchin, their reluctance to go down to pursue these things or to support these measures is far more performative in many instances than some of the more centrist or, you know, so-called moderate Democrats who are against these things because their donor class is against them, as opposed to it being part of their brand back home, where being a maverick is helpful.
You're right. And it is, I think it's different from the days when the deciding vote was someone like Joe Lieberman, who like was like, I will blow this up because it's what my donors want, what the industry that I represent, what they want. I am willing to blow this up. And people knew that dealing with Lieberman. It has not come up yet, but I don't think Manchin and Sinema are the same sort of politician, but no one even wants to like dare that.
So Ron Wyden and Bernie Sanders have both begun already discussing their plan B. Their plan B is essentially to impose a 5% tax penalty on large corporations. We don't know exactly how that would be defined, but one can imagine if any of their workers earn less than a certain amount, with that penalty increasing over time. So it's almost like the flip side of the $15 minimum wage that would be phased in over the course of 4 years. This would sort of do the opposite. Okay, you're not going to pay your employees. We're going to increase your taxes, so your costs are going to be just as high. And then the other side of that is that you would get essentially a tax subsidy up to 25%. This is a tax credit, so it's basically a payment of up to 25% of wages. Up to $10,000 per year per employer to that boost wages that would come the higher your employee wages go. So it would, and obviously one's imagining that they're going to construct this in such a way to get to the $15 minimum wage in the same sort of fashion. Give me your sense of that.
I mean, it sounds like an ideal plan if you love complexity, making things difficult to understand. Making it difficult to point to a benefit that you directly gave someone, sinking that benefit. I mean, it's a workaround. So I don't think it's not like they came out with this plan first. It'd be one thing if this was like the Democrats were like, this is our first ideal plan A. But you can definitely see like this is the fruit of typical Democratic policymaking right here. Like this is how they design things. And I mean, I think the end result would obviously be better than doing nothing. But it's a plan complicated enough that I can't figure out like what it would look like in action.
Do you think that it is, I mean, do you think this plan B is designed to bring the material benefits, or, and maybe it's not an or question, maybe it's an and question, but also maybe to sort of say like, look, to the Biden administration, to, you know, Manchin and Sinema, to whomever it is, this is going to happen in one way or another. And we can do it in, you know, this way where you're going to be accused of raising taxes or whatever it is. But this is going to happen because this is tax policy. Nothing's more, you know, bird rule friendly than tax policy. So this is going to happen. If you don't want it to be this sort of ugly and inelegant, then do something. Or do you think it's just like, we're just going to provide this material benefit to workers.
I think it's because at this point with the parliamentarian, it's sort of it's again, like we've just been talking about, would rely still on Harris. I think it really is just about like, well, how do we get this through these? How do we get the material benefit through this process that is sort of needlessly complex? I mean, I think that I would almost wonder if having this fallback is part of why they are sort of giving in on not challenging the parliamentarian, you know, like, we'll just get to it another way.
But what is the political value? Like, if I'm Kamala Harris and I'm thinking there's a good chance I'm going to run in 2024, right? I mean, you know, let's be honest. Joe Biden, I think it's not a controversial statement to say there's a decent chance that Joe Biden will not run for a second term. I don't. And if I'm Kamala Harris and people are going to be getting the benefit, at least partially, of a $15 minimum wage, and the only thing I get out of it politically is that I wouldn't do this to help it. Like, they're like, this is so classically Democratic as a party that it's, I mean, it's almost like, you know, when they say, like, you know, what's the definition of, you know, in the encyclopedia, they'd put this picture in there, right? We're going to make it kludgy. We're going to make it complicated. And we're going to make it so that we get no political value out of it. Because we can't point to the $15 minimum wage and you can't fit on a bumper sticker. We're the ones who passed the 5% gradually increasing tax penalty on one end, and on the other end, we did the 25% tax credit based upon your small business. Like, I mean, come on.
You know, that tax credit your employer got for maybe raising your wage, that was us. The one you can't see, that was all us. I'm sure your audience already has heard or knows that the Republicans under Bush just fired the parliamentarian. Like, they were just like, we don't like this, you're fired.
What happened after that? They put in another parliamentarian who ruled the way they wanted to?
Yeah. And that was it for, I think, I forget which bill it was, but it was in Bush's first term really early on when the Republicans still had the majority. Now, of course, the lesson there is that they lost the majority because the Republican senator flipped shortly after that. But, like, they got their bill.
Yeah. And I think, like, at this point, we know, like, okay, maybe Joe Manchin flips. I don't know. Does he? Is that a worry that Joe Manchin's going to flip if Kamala Harris overrules the parliamentarian?
Yeah, I mean, Manchin doesn't seem like it to me. Sinema's a maybe. Like, Sinema's a maybe. Manchin has been through so much as a Democrat in a state that's increasingly hostile to Democrats. He feels like he's sticking with it. But yeah, I don't know. Sinema's such a wild card.
Yeah, but she wears funky clothes and does her a little bit different. So she's a maverick.
Well, I mean, if there is a concern that she would flip to the Republican Party over this, I mean, that's understandable on one level. But then you also got to make the calculation like, OK, is it worth it? I mean, you know, there's two more bites at the reconciliation apple, I guess. And I don't know, maybe Kristen Sinema feels that secure in her reelection chances as a Republican in that state. But Arizona seems to be moving, trending in the other direction, doesn't it?
I just don't see. I really think that they're operating more out of a place of fear when it comes to this $1.9 trillion stimulus. They don't want the benefits to expire on, what, March 14th, mid-March, when the past unemployment and all those other things expire. So they're not going to push the envelope in any way. But, I mean, like, does that not show also that they're previewing a very non-aggressive approach for the rest of his presidency, because this is the time when you're supposed to be aggressive within the early parts of his term.
I think that's right. Yeah. And I mean, it does feel like, I guess, you know, what we were afraid of and what we were sort of reassured wouldn't happen, which is that Joe Biden, the institutionalist, would, like, his return to normalcy would be basically like, you know, they told us, oh, we learned all the lessons of Barack Obama's first term. We learned all those lessons. And then, you know, here we are, like, allowing a sort of institutional hurdle to kill a campaign promise that Joe Biden's been making for 4 years. I think he was at $15 4 years ago. And we can't really explain why we're doing it. And we want to make it seem like it's not our fault, but we can't quite explain why we're not doing it. That's not a great sign for how aggressive they'll be on stuff that's going to be more controversial. Like, I feel like anything related to the climate or anything else.
And we know this is a bill that has 70+% yeah. support from the American public, 60% support from Republicans.
Yeah.
I mean, so what is the value of having a bill that popular? You know, the value is ostensibly that you have room and latitude to make it a little bit less popular.
Yeah.
That's the concern, right? I mean, this is a real problem for Joe Biden, because it seems to me that the calculus is, because you've been hearing more about this, right? That we're going to have an explosion of economic activity. Like, have you noticed that over the past couple of weeks? We're starting to read more, and it's quite possible. You know, I mean, like, I certainly, I'm ready for summer to come, and I'm going to get vaccinated, and I'm going out every night, and I'm going to eat at restaurants, like, in a way I probably never have in my life. And
Sam's going to be at every bar in Brooklyn.
I'm going to hit every bar in Brooklyn. You can see me on my constant rolling pub crawl. I mean, I can understand, you know, sort of like, and maybe that'll be the case. Maybe it won't be, because there's also a lot of people who are hurting. But one gets the sense that they have pivoted in the past couple of weeks to this idea of, you know what? We've gotten 50 million doses out of vaccine. We're way ahead of where we promised we would be on 100 million doses in 100 days. Like, they're going to get close to 200 million doses, I would predict, in 100 days. And by July or by September, we could be seeing like an economic expansion. Maybe we don't need to do these things to secure, you know, 2022 or something like that. I mean, there just seems to be a little bit of like hedging, because otherwise it's sort of like, why are they? There's a lot of own goaling here, right? With the $1,400 and the minimum wage. I mean, it just seems bizarre.
Yeah, I think that is actually a good analysis. If you're like just sort of thinking like there's all this, you know, pent up economic demand and that it's going to explode once people are vaccinated and we're going to get the credit for it. We're going to get the credit for the vaccines. You're like, we're sitting pretty, right? Like, we don't have to go the extra mile. We don't have to do anything too politically difficult, because all the trends are going in the right direction. Which, you know, is again, not a great sign for like aggressive action on things that are less popular than a $15 minimum wage.
Well, I mean, it's needlessly handcuffing yourself, right? Like, they may be correct in their calculus that the vaccine is going to, as Pelosi said, it's an answer to our prayers, that it's coming and it will increase economic activity and things are going to get better. And like the contrast to COVID under Trump to COVID under Biden, it's going to be beneficial to Biden, no doubt. But then why use that to play prevent defense? Like why yeah. conservative, you know, when you're up a little bit, you got to just, you know, put them away to use sports analogies, as opposed to playing scared, because that always comes back to bite Democrats. And yet they consistently do yeah. it.
I mean, I think this is a good time to pivot to your story about Rush Limbaugh, because to a certain extent, what we're talking about is a throwback in terms of the way that Democrats react. And in this way, it's just even more bizarre. Like, you know, in the aughts when we would watch this and see Democrats cower, we would see them cowering at something. Maybe we could argue whether they should be cowering, but now it's like they're scared of their own shadow. There's nothing else there. Like, the Republican Party is literally like, they are living in a different universe than seemingly everybody else. It's not to say that they're not as maybe like, you know, they have the ability to bring those people out in the universe, but there's nobody going on Sunday. John Thune went out there and said, you know, I made $6 an hour, and within 30 seconds, every single publication in the country was going like, hey, dude, that's $20 an hour. Like, what are you talking about? Like, there's no counter arguments here. Let's talk about that with Limbaugh, because it's like the Democrats are the last people to realize that that element of conservatism has been at the very least sequestered. It's not participating. Explain that dynamic in terms of Limbaugh as well.
Yeah, so I think for a lot of people, maybe a little bit younger than me, Rush Limbaugh was just sort of a figure of the conservative media, right? Like, he was like, the conservatives have their own media. He was a titan within that world. But he was like just sort of a part of that sort of separate infrastructure. I think people who remember his actual heyday know that he used to be a mainstream figure, right? Like, it wasn't that, like, Rush Limbaugh helped make talk radio into an arm of the conservative media. But beginning in the 90s, and especially in the Clinton years, like, Rush Limbaugh was just a part of the whole mass media landscape. You saw him on regular TV. He had a short-lived syndicated television show, but he was just like, he was treated as someone sort of outrageous and someone sort of bombastic, and but also as like, I read this New York Times profile of him from 1990, I think, that basically just described him as sort of a guilty pleasure. You know, they were like, you know, this guy says some pretty out there stuff, but, you know, he's pretty funny. You got to give him that. He's pretty funny. And like, the stuff that was pretty funny was like this just lame anti-PC, like, just pointing at people who are different and finding that self-evidently funny. And so I think like the country's gotten less white since then. But it's also just like, we don't let those sorts of people, we don't treat them as completely normal participants in this mass media anymore. And I think that's sort of what some comedians don't like, that has changed. it was definitely like Rush was what represented how incredibly different the media landscape was back when conservatives actually needed the mainstream media to get platforms.
And to be clear, you know, like, obviously Donald Trump giving Rush Limbaugh the medal of was it freedom or honor, which giving him anything is cartoonish. But what people forget, George Herbert Walker Bush, because I am older than you, and I do remember this. George Herbert Walker Bush, not George W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush called into his show. I mean, really touted how much Rush Limbaugh was important. Now, this is like, you know, only 3 or 4 years into Limbaugh's thing. I mean, this is what you write about in your piece. The implications of it are both like, there's a whole subset of what it means for, you know, so-called cancel culture, which is really just the extension of, you know, anti-PC, which is really just sort of, in my parlance, the sort of gaseous form of the more liquid, solid form of just racism and bigotry and, you know, homophobia and xenophobia, et cetera, et cetera. It's just sort of like, you know, when it evaporates a little bit and it turns into like gas form, that's basically what they're talking about. And that stuff was far more acceptable in mainstream media. And this is, you know, in mainstream media, in society at large, and it influenced the politics much more so as well. I mean, in addition to like the sort of like so-called, you know, like cultural aspects of it, the cultural political aspects, like the actual politics, because if George Herbert Walker Bush is calling into Rush Limbaugh, who is, you know, literally just months away from saying that Hillary Clinton dragged Vince Foster into a park after she had him murdered, people have to understand what the implications are of like what was the mainstream of the mainstream at that time was equally that far, not equally that far right, but it was the dynamic was very right at that time. And it's like the Democrats are still living in the middle 90s, but there's nobody there. It's like they're cowering from somebody whose hand is raised like this at them, ready to smack them, but there's nobody there.
They're facing a wall or something like that, or they're in a different room.
I mean, I don't, like, what donor, what base of the party is saying, or you know, like, what actual force, right? I mean, because the other answer is that they're not afraid of, like, the political backlash. They're afraid of their donor class. But I honestly don't think that there is a donor class out there that is saying to Joe Biden, we don't want a $15 minimum wage.
Well, that's also why, and then let me just add, and then Alex, I want you to weigh in, like, that's also why the Democratic Party so quickly coalesced behind a $15 minimum wage, too, because it was one of the least controversial elements of Bernie Sanders' platform in 2016. That was one of the concessions with Hillary Clinton to that donor class. I think you're right. It's not very controversial with them.
I think that's absolutely right too, and you know, also the fight for 15 has been going on a while, and that $15 is worth a little bit less to the donors every year it goes on. I mean, it's a little bit less of a threat to them every year it stays at the fight for 15. But you know, you look, I mean, the Democratic donor, especially the Democratic donor base, like, we're talking large corporations that are large employers. These places are already paying wages more than that. I mean, when they're not like Amazon does subcontracting to people they pay pennies, their actual employees who they would be responsible for are paid well above $15 an hour. Costco just, like, voluntarily raised their wages. It really is these, like, I don't think it's a donor class opposition, because, like, the large employers are fine with it at this point.
I mean, it's just like, I want people just sort of, like, marinate in the absurdity of the Biden administration thinking that the political costs of overruling the parliamentarian are greater than not passing this. And even if you pass it in the form of, like, the tax subsidies and the tax cuts and the, like, which we all know, like, look, you know, it's just a matter of time before those taxes are rolled back at one point. I mean, we'll fix it in the next reconciliation bill. We'll roll it back or whatever it is. I mean, It is astonishing how sort of tone deaf the establishment, I guess, of the Democratic Party is, right? I mean, it's just even, I don't know, it's like even in their own best interest at this point. It's just absurd. And this is one of those things I think is going to haunt Kamala Harris in a way that I think they don't really fully appreciate.
Right. I think so too. Yeah. I mean, and it's like, I think what I find very strange is that you can't, so far that I've seen, you can't get someone major in the administration come out and explain this. Right. Cause, like, we all know Harris has this power. And I think they're sort of acknowledging it, but saying she won't use it. And, like, I would like the vice president to sort of come on TV and tell me why. I don't think she will, because I don't think there's a great explanation. But, you know, I would like to hear one from her.
Well, they can admit that this is office politics to them.
Yeah, totally.
Like, they can admit that this is we're trying to keep these interpersonal relationships together in the caucus more than, like, they value the process. They value those office politics more than they value fighting for a minimum wage on behalf of people. And that, like, just almost, it really highlights the schism between leftist senators, the more activist left, and the old guard of the Democratic Party, who could not be better represented by Joe Biden. And Kamala Harris doesn't have any politics. I mean, that's the thing, is, like, that's what you hear from Democratic insiders too, right? Is she's kind of somebody who molds herself to what she needs to be in a certain situation. And yeah, I think her brand of politics, it's going to be very problematic in 2024. She has big ambitions, but the fact that she has no ideology, that's going to be an issue, because look at how popular $15 minimum wage is. you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think Harris is someone who definitely tries to see what direction things are going, and then tries to sort of make herself that politician. But I mean, you know, it's going to come down to, no matter what, is like, I think that there are like, there's probably a politician would think like, well, 4 years from now, no one's going to remember that I didn't do this one thing. But what's going to happen 4 years from now is they're going to like point, you're going to need something to point to say, here's the thing I did, right? Like, people might forget this little arcane parliamentarian stuff, but like, you're going to need something. You're going to need a record. You're going to need some record to point to in a few years.
Especially because I don't think she's that talented or charismatic. Like, that's going to be an issue.
Well, we'll see with that. But what's fascinating to me is that they're on the verge of passing a $1.9 trillion bill. And, you know, there's some of the shape of it. We're not sure. Chuck Schumer, it's interesting. Chuck Schumer, there was a story yesterday that Chuck Schumer was, you know, brought some senators in and said, look, I don't want to change anything in this bill right now, because there were some of those moderate Democratic senators who, and I was anticipating something worse from them, but they supposedly were responding to some governors who were saying, we're going to use these state funds to cut taxes, which just absurd, you know, particularly in light of the tax cuts in 2017, but just in general, like, tax cuts, if you're worried about economic activity, tax cuts are the least efficient way to provide this type of stimulus. And they wanted to target it to more sort of like infrastructure stuff that would have a direct bearing on people's lives, to basically prevent these states from cutting taxes. Using the money to cut taxes, which I thought was, I mean, if it's actually, as they report it, not necessarily a bad idea. Chuck Schumer brought them in ostensibly to tell them, like, I want to keep this solid. But I also wonder if this isn't a way to also keep the plan B for the $15 minimum wage out.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
You know, like, if he hadn't anticipated, if the parliamentarian says this, then I say that, as a way of keeping that out. But what we have is a $1.9 trillion bill that is going to extend unemployment benefits, $400 on top of what you get from the state, extend it out to August. This is relative to like what passed in December with the Republicans. You've got funding for schools. You've got funding. You've got adult dependents getting the $1,400 check, which wasn't part of the last couple of checks that went out. You've got support for schools and for hospitals, and there's a lot of good things that are commendable in this $1.9 trillion bill. I mean, it's a significant bill, and broadly, the story is going to be, you guys didn't do this and that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how they managed to fail politically, even on their own terms, just stunning. I mean, this is, reminds me of like the ACA. Let's push the Affordable Care Act part of this, as opposed to the parts that are actually like delivering, which are the patient protections, which everybody embraces now. And we saw that in the last fight, right? Like, you're gonna eliminate pre-existing conditions. Well, you know, it took them 10 years to find out what was popular about the Affordable Care Act. And it wasn't the affordable part. It was the patient protections, which was actually part of the name of the bill. And the Democrats didn't even understand what was popular about their own bill. And the other part that was popular about is the expansion of Medicaid. And they never promoted that either. And I feel like we're watching another version of that.
Yeah. And unlike the Republicans, they don't have any emotional, cultural things to fall back on, which help them.
It's stunning.
Yeah.
I think this is a real, this is a test here. This is a major test, because this, we elected the trust the process. We got this. We know how this Congress stuff works. We've been doing this a long time. We elected that crew, and they're saying this bill is something of a high wire act. It has this deadline. It has to be huge. It has to cover all these disparate things. So, you know, people like us were saying in January, like, all right, like, we got to eliminate or at least alter the filibuster. We can just pass a bunch of different things while you're working on the stimulus. We can get checks out. We can get vaccine funding. We can do that now while you work on this big stimulus. And they were saying, no. We're going to do it the way, we're going to do it by the book. So now we're going to see. They promised they know how to do these things by the book. They're doing the legislative process the way they know how to do it. And we'll see what the result is soon.
I just want to point out what you're alluding to. This is like, you know, I think you mentioned this in one of your pieces. David Dayen was calling it checks and shots.
Yeah.
Early on, which was pass something that everybody can agree on. And, you know, sort of like the low hanging fruit, checks, shots.
Yeah.
What everybody's in favor of, pass that and then do the rest during reconciliation. And the implication about putting the checks and shots, like we're going to delay this a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, a month, whatever it is. You know, we're only a month out from when the president took over. But he could have signed the bill. You know, I mean, could have done it by like a couple of weeks ago. The idea was like, if we put the checks and shots in the reconciliation, nobody can afford to vote against it if there's stuff in there that's a little bit more controversial. Right. But now they're not putting the controversial stuff in. It's like, what? Why did you save this stuff for leverage if you're not going to use it?
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, that was, and I guess like there was like, I don't know. It's kind of a hard argument to figure out too, because it seems like we got to keep the checks and shots in the big bill so that everyone supports it. But it's like, well, you're doing it through reconciliation, so you weren't expecting Republican support for it. And like, did you really think that like after the checks and shots were out, Manchin and Sinema would be like no more stimulus, no more anything in reconciliation? I mean, I guess like that's the implication. But otherwise, yeah. I mean, like if now we're just losing these things that were supposed to be the like we're like reusing the checks to get this other good liberal stuff in there, then I don't know. I don't know where we're at.
Right. If your argument is we need the checks and shots in there because that's the thing that's going to, I mean, there's no way that Manchin and Sinema can vote against that. Well, then where's the stuff that you're putting in that they were worried about voting for?
Yeah.
What's in the bill that is offensive in any way to Joe Manchin at this point? Has he articulated a single thing that is problematic? Same with Sinema.
Well, because it's not, again, it's not about the legislation for them. It's about a branding exercise, as you say, which makes it a lot more flexible. And if the Biden administration was willing to flex its muscle in that area, then you could find out, okay, how can we finagle this so you can represent yourself in a specific way?
McConnell's great at this too, because McConnell lets his moderates take no votes when they aren't important.
Exactly.
McConnell like he'll make sure he has enough votes to pass. I mean, he barely passed anything, but when it came down to it, he would like give wiggle room to Collins and Murkowski and be like, all right, I don't need your vote on this one. Like do a nice rebellious no vote on this one and have fun.
Nice to have Schumer in that position, but the Biden administration is so quick to preemptively surrender that they're not like, I don't even blame Schumer in this instance. They're not giving him an opportunity to do exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can probably come up with a reason to blame Schumer on this, but I'm sure he's happy to not be on the hot seat with this one.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm sorry, in the middle of a pandemic, the idea that somebody's going to vote against aid for people when, who is it that wants to be the one person or even the two people, right? I mean, it's one thing if there's 10 Democrats who are not going to vote for this.
The point is just that he's not the villain in this story. It's Biden and the whole Biden administration, in my view.
I mean, they're making a huge mistake, I think, both politically and in terms of like the policy here. And it is, I don't know, it's just absurd. I mean, there's so much own goaling here that it's really hard to understand. I mean, you know, like just even the $2,000 check, like there's no donors out there who are saying like $1,400 is okay. But if you're going to do that extra $600, no way. Like who, like it is, yeah. It is, they are, they're like, they're facing, it's like they think they're performing in the round and they're turning around and there's nobody in those seats. There's nobody in those seats. Everybody's sitting out in front of you and they're performing to people and there's nobody in those seats and there's nobody there. There's no constituency that's going like 2,000. That's crazy. 14.
This is what gets me about it, right? Like there's no constituency. There's not a group of people who are like, I really think that people, like, you got to send people a smaller check or else I'm going to be real mad. Like, that's not a normal voter's response.
Yeah.
I feel the same way, this preemptive fear when it comes to, like, Biden's incredible reluctance to relieve student loan debt, where he's like, what is he imagining? He's imagining, like, again, like a news segment where someone's like, this hippie doesn't owe any money anymore.
Right.
And, like, I don't think it's a different country. Like the audience is, it's like not, that's not the kind of stuff that plays anymore.
Alex Perrin, co-host of The Politics of Everything and staff writer at New Republic. Thank you so much. Always, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Alex.
Of course. Thank you.
All right. Quick break. We'll be right back. Finish off the week. Oh, well, Alex still with us. Good. I guess we're going to know, within the next couple of days as to what will happen with this plan B. Bernie Sanders seems pretty determined. Ron Wyden seems pretty determined to make this happen by hook or crook. And we'll have a better sense next week of where that stands. That seems to me to be the only sort of extant stuff about this $1.9 trillion bill. And, you know, I imagine they're going to end up voting on this within, maybe by the end of next week.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the schedule is anymore. It always seems like the bill's a little bit of a black box, especially now without this part of it. Right. Like, so I don't really know. It feels like it just depends on how if they think that the House and Senate versions are like going to be able to get along well enough.
We shall see. All right. For those of us leaving, we will see you next week. And for those of us who are staying, we'll see you right now.
I'd like to include us in the, for those of us leaving. We're not leaving.
But Alex, we'll say goodbye unless you have anything else to add other than appreciate you using your kid's Zoom today.
Yeah, no Zoom class for him, but for me today.
There you go. All right, have a good weekend, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. You too.
I'll see you later. And now I think we've got. Do we have film guy Matthew? Do we have him yet? Boom! Wow!
Wow!
The next bearded guy wearing glasses that we're bringing on today. Matthew, film guy. We can't talk to you until we hear. Do we have it, Brendan?
No, that's Matt.
I don't think so.
Well, we don't.
Just sing it, Sam. You know it. Just sing it.
I don't know.
Matthew, film guy. Isn't that just basically the words over and over again?
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such things. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, film guy.
I got to tell you, I cannot believe you fell for that. That's exactly what I
fell for. We discussed this. I wear the beard and the glasses, and then I...
When he won't answer a question I know he knows the answer to, I will say... Something
you don't know that. Yeah.
He will, and then he'll say no. So I'll go, this is my son, Steve, and he's like, Saul. And then I'm like, that type of thing. So I'm glad to see it works on you as well. Matthew, film guy, how are you? How are you doing? You look actually quite good. I mean, if not a little bit,
Actually.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Listen, let's not make this about my appearance. I don't like those kinds of comments. I get very uncomfortable. Okay, so the beard is still growing. That's all you need to know. I'm afraid of going to the barber. So I went once during the pandemic, and let's see how it goes. And when I'm not afraid, I'll go again.
I haven't been to the barber in almost probably a year now. I cut my own hair. I got one of those, like,
Flobee?
No. You know what? I've been trying to get a Flobee. I have
classic.
I just have a shaver And I, you know, every now and then I'll hit it like this. And then if I wake up in the morning and there's something sticking out, I just cut it. Do you not have scissors? Do you need me to send you scissors?
No, Sam, listen, we live in a service economy, and I'm not going to take jobs away from hardworking people that need our money right now. So I'm going to wait until I can actually give the professionals a chance to do their business. Listen, you're working with a little bit better material than I am. Let's be honest here. So I can't mess around. I need professional service on this to make it work. All right. Meanwhile, I just let it go.
I don't know about you, but like if I wait too long to get a haircut, I feel, or it's like waiting too long to go to the dentist. They like kind of shame you. Yeah. I'm like, oh, yes. A lot of split.
The tip is like triple at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I was like, thank you for shaming me. I know you want me to come more often so I can pay you, but you don't need to make me feel bad about how I look.
Well, that's why I go to a barber that anything over $25, I don't even walk into that store. It's like, yeah. I'm like a 20 buck barber.
Jesus, I've envied men.
But Matthew Film Guy, what is the latest? I have to say I've been getting rave reviews about your class. I have members of my family who are participating in your class.
Are you talking to them right now?
What do you mean, as I speak?
Yeah, I thought you were maybe getting some messages from them. Yes, your family is a big fan of my classes, thanks to you, and a couple new students just from Majority Report listener audience. So it's been a lot of fun. They've been a great addition to the class, and it's been excellent.
And
broadening the horizons.
Oh, have you been on since I've watched Black Bear?
No. So if you want, floor is yours, Sam.
Have you not been on since like December?
Yeah. You know, I'm like in like a 2-month-ish rotation, right? That's about right.
Oh my gosh. So I watched Black Bear. I thought it was...
You what?
I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was great.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you.
I really thought it was great. I mean, I texted you, but I didn't. It just occurred to me that you haven't been on since then. Tell everybody about it.
Black Bear is a film, independent film that played at Sundance last year, right around this time. And it stars Aubrey Plaza and Sarah Gadon and Christopher Abbott in a kind of mind-bendy, various stories that may or may not match together, kind of mind-fuck, if I may use the French term. A story about drama and relationships and the creative process. It's a lot to do with the sacrifices people make in order to be creative and to achieve sort of their artistic vision. But also it's just about the relationships between men and women and those sort of quotidian things that the kinds of movies that I love really tend to explore. So check it out. It's on all your video on-demand streaming services still. And Aubrey Plaza, who you know, Sam, you don't know her, but for most people who know her as a comedic genius, she is actually puts in a tour de force dramatic performance in this film. And it's quite a sight to behold. She's been nominated for a couple different awards. And it's been great to see her getting her due as a dramatic actress.
For sure.
I really thought it was... I thought it was, you know, exceptional, the film. I really did.
Thank you, Sam.
It was great. The editing was fantastic.
Thank you.
I found it interesting and compelling. And, you know, I feel like I rarely ever say that about anything I see anymore. Now, part of that is because 90% of the movies I watch are with my son.
Kids' movies, yeah. This movie gives a little bit, inspires a little bit more conversation afterwards than like the Paw Patrol films or whatever it is.
I feel badly. I haven't watched it yet, but I will on Saturday. I'm making this commitment to myself. But we're getting IMs from people who say that they've
it was great. And so, all right. So I guess maybe I don't even have a sense of what would happen in a non-pandemic time in the wake of a film like that. I mean, I have to imagine it is difficult for everybody involved in the making of that film, because back in a non-pandemic time, It would go to a film festival. Then you would go to another film festival with it. And you would be at this point, you probably wouldn't even be available because you'd be going like, oh, I'm at the Bermuda Film Festival. I'm in Bern, Switzerland at the Bern Film Festival. I'm making these up. I'm down in Orlando at the Orlando Film Festival. And then you're meeting people and you're developing, you're networking. I mean, that's what the film industry is. And now, you're just sitting in your office waiting for me to Zoom you for like what? Is it frustrating?
I mean, yeah, it's a little frustrating. It's a little disappointing, but you know what? It's like, I'm so excited just to have had the film out and have people actually discuss it that like the professional side of things, the sort of mercenary side of things, I'm a little less upset about it just because it's been so gratifying to actually hear people's responses and to get into conversations with people online and just to have the film out there and having people discuss something that you spent your heart and soul and time and blood and sweat and tears to create. So that alone has been great. I mean, yeah, I recognize the loss of what you're saying. And really the director, Larry Levine, who's, this is his fourth or fifth film. He's the one telling me like, oh, we would have been doing this. We would have been doing that because he's done it a lot. He's probably actually more glad that he doesn't have to do a lot of that stuff. He's kind of over it. But there actually has played a bunch of other festivals virtually. So there's been a lot of Zoom Q&As, things like that, that the director has done. The editor is not exactly the main attraction in any of these things. I did get to go to Sundance, though. So that was sort of like the big enchilada. So as long as I had that and I got to do that, I feel pretty well satisfied. And right, I didn't get to go to Savannah or whatever, what have you.
That was like a year ago now, almost.
Yeah.
Exactly, right?
This year, Sundance just ended and it was mostly virtual. So, yeah, it was a year ago.
Wow.
And
I guess that must have been right after the Nevada caucuses, too. Right? I don't know if you're.
Yeah, definitely. It was. And, it was still sort of like you're still in a sort of a political daze, right? Those few weeks of January. But to be honest, we were joking at the Sundance Film Festival. We should do a movie about an outbreak that starts at a film festival because it was like it was just starting to start. And yeah. It felt like people were getting sick. So it was just on the cusp of things getting nuts.
It is sort of fascinating. And it occurs to me that, like, you know, I am trying to think of, like, you know, as I was walking to work today, and it's sort of like, you know, it's still chilly out, but there is a sense of, like, spring is coming. And I felt more optimistic today. And also, like, you wake up in the morning, like, my son woke me up, as he does every morning, like, 6:30. I'm like, it's light out.
Oh my
God. It's not dark. And
yeah, that's been great.
It's weird that we're now at a year into this, this pandemic and been living under these sort of pandemic rules. My son's birthday is coming up. It was the last birthday that any of his friends attended in person. And we just squeaked by. Like it was March 7th. And that weekend, which was, you know, it was the 13th, 15th that they shut the schools down, really 13th, because that was a Friday in New York anyways. And I was telling the people, we were at like a bouncy gym place. They actually called Bounce U.
That's sweet.
And I was telling them, like, and I brought like a bunch of hand sanitizers for everybody because it wasn't quite here yet. But I was like, and people thought I was a little bit weird about doing it. And I had said to the guys at I said, like, you know, I don't know if you guys are going to be open next week. And they're like, oh, we'll be fine. And, you know, I don't think they were, but,
narrator, they were not fine.
What do you like, you know, cause I don't really think in this modality anymore, but from like an art perspective, from like a film world, is there like, do you anticipate any type of response to this? Cause on some level, I can understand why the 1918 pandemic was sort of like forgotten as soon as it was over. Part of it, obviously, because it was a war going on and, you know, and everything else was happening. But like, I never want to think about this era again.
Listen, you know as well as I do that the film world is almost completely, if not, you know, primarily driven by commercial concern. So if there's an audience that wants to see things about the hell we've been through, then there will be films that meet that need. There have been a few attempts. There was that really cheesy, I don't know if it was Michael Bay, like, yeah. it's like right, Emma, you saw that?
I did heard shitty things.
Yeah, I mean, the trailer alone, I wish I had never seen it. But there is, you know, I think there'll be an attempt to exploit it. And then if the market comes back and says, no, thank you, then it's not going to happen. So listen, for me personally, I don't feel compelled to tell a story about this. I don't, you know, maybe you'll see some masks appear in a film here and there. I know there's whole episode, whole series, seasons of TV shows that Mary watches. I forget what medical show it is. The one about the doctor with autism. And that's all... or maybe it's Grey's Anatomy. I get all the medical shows confused. What, Emma? It's
called The Good Doctor, and it comes.
The Good Doctor.
It comes on after The Bachelor, so sometimes I catch the first 10 minutes.
All right, they'll be glad to know they get that lead in from you. But they're using it to tell these kinds of stories. So you know, I find it exploitative and kind of disturbing. But that doesn't mean that some people won't find a way to make it compelling and interesting.
But I'm not. You're not Matthew movie guy. You're Matthew film guy. So I'm not asking you about like whether it'll be commercially exploited.
Those are the only compelling reasons I can think of that it wouldn't happen. You know, like if people are sick of it. If Larry's next movie is about a pandemic at a film festival, I'll be there. Anything, pain, suffering, war, disease, loss, anger, hatred. These are all ripe topics for a film for artistic manipulation and expression. So I don't see why it would be any different for, you know, something as exhaustive and all consuming as this pandemic has been.
Well, wait, I have a quick question, though, about the film industry. I know you're Matthew film guy. You're not film industry guy. But...
Yeah, this isn't a variety corner, but go ahead.
But okay. Some people are saying that because of the pandemic, things have changed indelibly in terms of movie releases, right? Like what we saw with HBO Max, with that terrible Wonder Woman movie. I can't believe I sat through that whole thing. The first one was so terrible. Being released on HBO Max and the blitz of all those movies, like being released sort of in theaters at the same time, but no one's going to the theaters. Like there was that whole issue with Tenet, because Christopher Nolan's artiste, and so he wanted his movie only released in theaters and wouldn't simultaneously release it on streaming platforms, and like, you know, whatever. It was a whole debacle from my understanding. Like, do you think that there's no going back and that there will be these movies like we were seeing it even before Netflix, you know, having movies released like The Irishman? What's your sense of that?
It feeds into a much greater narrative or issue, let's say, of, you know, we're still seeing the verticalization of the movie industry in a way that used to have laws against the ability to do so. So now Netflix owns theaters. You know what I'm talking about, Sam. It's
laws that were repealed in 86 for television. I mean, these laws were perfect example. I mean, really a model actually for antitrust. You can't have the movie theaters own the movie studios or vice versa because they'll shut out their competitors at the movie theaters.
And they used to be able to force you to do things like, I know this movie's probably going to be shitty, so we're not going to give you the blockbuster if you don't take the shitty one. I mean, so it's a bigger change just into the, you know, my take is as the commercial cinema and who's driving a lot of this learns more and more how little they need to actually think about anything other than just spectacle as just these huge commercial enterprises. Most of these movies are just their marketing campaign, because once you buy a ticket, once you download it, it doesn't even matter. They've got your money. So as long as they can get you into downloading something or buying it, why bother paying rent on these giant buildings? Why bother owning these vast modes of distribution when you've already got a computer and we've got it here and we can make the same money or more? Now, if it turns out that people aren't going to be paying as much, and look, I subscribed to a bunch of streaming services and they all just keep going up and up. Oh, it's going to be another dollar this month. As long as they can't keep edging you out for that, and they need to find some way to entice you to go see a movie. Oh, like it used to be like, oh, it went right to video, it must suck. No, now it's like, great, Wonder Woman, whatever it is, the same shitty movie is going to be in a theater, is going to be at home. As long as they can do that, then that will inevitably derail it and make it streaming only. But I tend to think people are still going to want to go see movies with a group of people, still going to want to see a thing in a room with people and laugh.
Yeah, that's literally the thing I miss most in maybe of like terms of like leisure activities, like not going to bars or even going out to dinner. I miss really going to the movies, and I feel like I've missed out on like a lot of the great movies that have come out this year just because my like ritual of going to I used to go to 2 movies a month. That was my deal, and like I just don't, you know, I missed out on that, you know. So it's a bummer.
I watched primarily the movies by myself anyway because I'm extremely persnickety. Like if somebody's got their phone out or somebody's talking or somebody's chewing their popcorn, I get so distracted. Like I need it to be like this hermetically sealed religious experience for me to really feel like I've seen the movie. So I'm not necessarily your target audience in terms of asking that question to, but you know, most of these big blockbuster movies, they're more like amusement park rides than going to church or something, you know. So it's no fun going on a roller coaster by yourself, really. And as long as those are the kinds of movies that are out there, I think they're going to want to have it be this group communal experience. So I think it's overhyped that it's dead forever, except for in the way that it was already dead forever compared to how much you get on your phone or on your tablet or on your computer, even before the pandemic.
We're getting a bunch of IMs. Black Bear was one of my favorite movies of 2020, says Teen Av.
Thank you.
A bunch of, I tend to think that there's going to be just, I think that there's going to be a real rush to go out at any opportunity. I don't know how long that's going to last, but I think there's going to be, maybe I'm just projecting, but I mean, who knows? I mean, uncharted territory, I guess.
Look, I didn't go out a lot in the first place, so I don't know if I'm going to be like, woo, and like one night I'll be like, all right, I got enough. That's fine.
Right. But be satiated pretty quickly.
I'm going to have such anxiety the first time I'm out without a mask and like an indoor. I mean, it's like I watch like TV shows that are from a different time and they don't have masks on and I freak out.
It is weird.
Yeah,
it is really weird. But I think that we're going to return quickly. Somebody wanted a Film Guy review of Cloud Atlas. What is that?
I actually liked it. It got a really bad rap, but it was a spacey kind of, I think it was it the Wachowski sisters? It was their, you know, the Matrix, people who did the Matrix. It was like this multi-pronged sort of galactic spanning story of Tom Hanks being different people throughout time. It was cool. It was weird. I liked it.
I heard it was weird, yeah.
All right, give me a couple of, all right, let's go back to old school because I, you know, the thing is I'm so removed from knowing what films are out there that I go and I look at, like, in the rare opportunities I get where I can actually, like, sit down and watch a movie that is not, you know, like, right now all the talk is Tom and Jerry is going to be released tonight.
And can you explain that to me? Tom and Jerry, something that was old when we were kids, and that's what the current market is saying. The kids want Tom and Jerry.
I said to Saul, I'm like, wait, what? Tom and Jerry, the cartoon? Yeah. And he's like, well, it's going to be partially animated with real animals. Like Saul loves animals. So he's just like, it's going to be partially animated with real animals. And
real cats are going to get a frying pan in the face. I don't know if I like that.
Can't wait to watch that. But, you know, so when I get an opportunity, a rare opportunity to watch a non-kids film, like I tried to get him to watch like Dark Knight.
But he likes superheroes. But yeah, show him the crypto fascist one to start. Yeah, that's great.
Well, we watched the other Batmans, and those are the fact that Joel Schumacher, is that his name? What was that again?
Yeah, Nipple Batman. Is that what you're talking about?
The fact that Joel Schumacher was allowed to make movies, I just like I remember you know back in the '90s, going like this guy shouldn't be allowed to make movies. And
you didn't like Flatliners. You didn't like Flatliners.
Falling Down's a great movie.
What is
Falling Down?
Falling Down. It's a great movie.
It's like a Taxi Driver riff. It was like the Joker before the Joker.
Oh, my God.
Michael Douglas.
He's got the baseball bat. I remember the whole thing.
He hates immigrants, Sam. He's angry.
It's just Joel Schumacher is like so ham-fisted with everything and just sort of like, I don't know. I've never
seen it, but it sounds
like Sam doesn't like camp.
I don't. Yeah. I don't like camp. I mean, anyways, so... The problem is I look at these movies and all the names just sort of bleed together. And, you know, occasionally somebody says like, watch Tenet. I'm like, okay. And
no,
I watch
don't,
that.
No, don't. Did you?
I watched it twice, two or three times, trying to figure
I like that one too. I think it's a bunch of nonsense, but it was entertaining nonsense, I thought.
Matthew, yeah. I'm interested in your letterbox. I see that you've watched so many movies, and you say that you've watched them, but you never leave reviews or any sort of rating on them.
Well,
just let us know
For the first like 4,000 or whatever it is, I kept a list just in a notebook from like 95 to like whenever I started this 2 or 3 years ago. So a bunch of them are just what I transcribed, just because when you watch a lot of movies, it helps to kind of have like a visual record and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, or I saw that. And it's like puts it in a different part of your brain to help you process. But I'm starting to write a few more. If you look in the past 2 years, you'll see I'm starting to give them ratings. But even the ratings brain, like I hate now that I'm watching a movie halfway through, I'm like, how many stars is this? Like that's a bad mm-hmm. place to be. Well, like I'm trying to.
What about just doing a Y or an N? Like what? Well, or don't watch it.
Yeah, I think like 3 stars and below is sort of like use your own judgment. And then 3 stars and above is like a Matthew Film Guy says, go for it. But it's hard because when you're judging like Tenet on its own sort of its own benefits, it's and then compare that to, you know, something that Tarkovsky made, it's like they're trying for different things. So a 4-star, 5-star rating system is pretty reductive in and of itself, too. So it's the whole idea is difficult. But Brendan, thank you for mentioning that, because Sam, if you're looking for something to watch, you can go to my Letterboxd at letterboxd.com with no E in the box /Langdon Boom. And you can see all the movies that I've recommended to you over the years that you haven't seen. And also all the movies that I've watched on a daily basis in my diary. And there's so much to choose from. I have a panoply of things, from exploitation movies to art house movies, to action movies, to documentaries. So you'll never be without something to look at besides Tom and Jerry.
Do it.
It's too overwhelming for me. Exactly. I can't make a decision. Like every day.
Throw a dart.
Every day. Oh,
wait,
here we
okay.
go.
Okay, oh. What do you think of
now look at
this in the Black Messiah? Did you watch that?
No, that's on my very short to see list coming up. I usually hate biopics because I'd much rather see a documentary that doesn't take liberties, but I'm aware enough of that story that I could watch that and try to enjoy it for what it is. Okay, this is in chronological order of what I've watched. It's like of the release. This isn't in the order that I've actually watched it in. So you might want to sort by when watched.
Sort by rating, because my problem is I go to that and I'm like, oh, Black Bear. I guess I'll watch that, even though I've already seen it. Like I can't.
You'll notice the second highest rated movie on there. These are all ones that I had something to do with. I'm unashamedly just super jacking up the ratings of anything I've had anything to do with. But
wait, Drive. Did you have something to do with that? I see.
No,
Drive
there. No, I just enjoyed it.
Thought it was good. And
I enjoyed that one very much. Albert Brooks is in that, Sam. If you haven't seen Drive, Albert Brooks, the way you've never seen him before. 4 Lions. I know you love that one. So your Elite Squad. These are a bunch that you have seen. That's so funny.
Gosling's so much. He's very good in that movie.
All right. Well, okay. So instead of all that, you got who's Caboose up there?
Nice. I've seen that several times.
I appreciate that. All right.
It's not objective. It's my take. Yeah.
What should I watch?
Okay. This week's movie that I had on tap for you to watch, just a quick aside, because I want to weigh in because I love it so much, is Adam Curtis's new documentary. People have been talking about it on the show a lot, so I'm not going to go too far into it. But the one thing I will say is that he calls himself a journalist, but he's really an artist, and he gets maybe some details wrong. He maybe has his reach exceeds his grasp, but he's trying to change your perception. He's trying to change the way your brain works, not necessarily give you information. He does that, and I'm grateful to him for all the breadth of things, historical moments that he's bringing to my attention. But that's like his greatest, hugest attempt. It's a 6-hour movie, Can't Get You Out of My Head. So if you have the time and the patience to watch that, I highly recommend it. It's not that there's nothing to quibble with it about, but I love what he does, and I'm a huge fan. But he's an artist, so art is different than history or politics or sociology, if you will. So there's limits there. But here's the movie I really want to tell your audience and you to watch, because it ticks all the boxes for this show's audience, I think for you as well. Sam will yawn now. I will pause. It's called Tony Erdmann, and it's directed by a German film directed by Maren Ade, who is a German filmmaker. This is only like her third, or I think maybe fourth film, third film. I've loved all of her films up until now. She sort of started out with her first film is sort of like a German mumblecore. It was like DV. She was right out of film school in the early 2000s. And she made this great movie about a girl who goes to his town and starts a new job. But Marinade's latest film, it's 4 or 5 years old now, Tony Erdmann, it's got elements of political sort of a commentary, a sort of a capitalist critique, if you will, wrapped into it. It's the story of a father, an overbearing father, and his sort of PMC daughter. He's this sort of, I forget what the German word is for a sort of middle class. Like, it's not Bürgermeister, but it's something like that. You know what I'm talking about? And it's
was in the like was Meister, Rudolf the Red Nose? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yes.
Right. But he's like a German boomer, and he's got this kind of Andy Kaufman-esque take, if you will. So it ticks an Andy Kaufman box for you, Sam. And he wants to try to get to know his daughter better, and she's this like high-end executive who's like very type A and very uptight. And he comes to where she works and kind of insinuates himself into where she works. And it is one of the funniest, most ridiculous movies that I've ever seen. It's got that kind of slow art cinema kind of pacing to it. It's not highly flashy visually. It's sort of very matter-of-factly directed, but the way it creates these scenes and the way it kind of plays with your expectations, it's it just blew my mind. It's definitely a 5-star movie on my Letterboxd, for whatever that's worth, if that means something to you. And everybody should go out and see it. It's, you know, it's in German, so if you speak German that helps, but I don't, and I still loved it. It's a little bit on the long side, but it's like, it goes by so fast, and it's got such moments of absurdity that I think you're going to be really surprised and really happy with it. I loved it.
Sweet. All right. So Tony Erdmann.
Yep.
E-R-D-M-A-N.
Yeah. Brendan had it up there for a second. Thank you, Brendan. That's definitely the best movie that I've seen in a long time.
Nice.
Well,
and I highly recommend it.
Matthew Film Guy. Couple of people want to say that I'm looking at the Joel Schumacher made Lost Boys.
Lost Boys. DC Cab. You weren't a fan of DC Cab?
Mr. T was in that, right?
Mr. T. I think a couple other comedians were in that, if I don't recall incorrectly.
Sonic, obviously a strong contender.
Sonic.
Hedgehog. With Jim Carrey, Saul. He's very excited about that.
Jim Carrey, right up his alley.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Sam. Sorry.
No, if you've seen Host.
Host, the Bong Joon-ho. Yes, I've seen it. It was pretty good. It was okay.
Horror movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it.
That's a new Bong Joon-ho movie?
No, it's like his third ago or something, I want to say. If that's the one that they're thinking of. About a sea monster. It's from 2006. Is there a newer one called The Host? I don't know.
I would imagine that's what she's talking about. I just...
It's a pandemic era horror movie, so I don't know.
Oh, then no, I have not. And I assume that Bong Joon-ho will have a lawsuit pending.
There you go. Well, you know, you can't trademark a title, can you?
Yeah, no, you can't. That's why I'm making a new film called Who's the Caboose? It'll be out next year.
I have one last question for Matthew, just if we can do like a quick side while we have
sure.
him. Or I could just email him, Sam, you call.
I got plenty of time. No, Brendan, come on. This is good TV.
And then we'll say goodbye.
I recently watched all the S. Craig Zahler movies that have come out. He's like a bit of a reactionary, exploitative filmmaker with a bit of a conservative streak. And I have to say, I really kind of enjoyed them in a way. Have you seen them?
Mask Off moment for Brendan.
No, I can't say I've seen one of them. Tell me his name again. I don't even recognize his name.
S. Craig Zahler. He did Bone Tomahawk about 5-6 years ago with Kurt Russell. And then he did something like Cell Block 99 with what's his name?
Who's a libertarian.
Yeah. And then Dragged Across Concrete with Mel Gibson and someone else.
Oh, I remember that one. So is this going to be like a hate watch kind of thing if I try to get into this, you think?
No, I think you might actually really like it.
Okay, cool. Thank you, Brendan. Going the opposite direction with the movie recommendations. I always appreciate that. Yeah, thanks. And just before we go, Sam, I just want to just put it out there that if any additional people care to join my class, we are signing up now for the summer session. And you can go to my Twitter and you can see a link to sign up for that at commonpointqueens.org. Their classes are coming up pretty soon. And we also are going to have one in November as well. We're keeping it in the Zoom range. So anyone across the world who's hearing my voice can join and watch a film one a week and then come and talk with some very intelligent folks from various walks of life about the film.
There you go. Matthew Film Guy.
Thank you, Sam. You are definitely not the worst guy on the internet.
I appreciate that.
That was
very sweet of you.
Greenwald reference.
Very, very sweet of you. Thank you.
Yep. I agree. So true.
Deep cut.
Wait, did he call me?
He said you weren't the worst guy on the internet.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I did not.
Who can argue with that? It's so true.
Yeah.
You know, I have mixed feelings because you always want to be a superlative, no matter what it
exactly.
is.
Keep trying. You'll get there.
You don't want to be stuck in the middle of the pack. Matthew Film Guy, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Sam.
Thanks, Matthew.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Okay, bye. I'm waiting for you to go. I don't want to talk about you while you're right.
You hit the button. You say goodbye. You hang up.
We can't.
Yeah, we can. I can say goodbye to that guy right there.
Boom. My next question for him is going to be, do we still have to pretend Clint Eastwood's directed movies are good at this point?
I mean,
Gran Torino sucks.
Gran Torino stinks. Play Misty for Me was pretty good. That was his first one. That is actually with Fatal Attraction. It's almost like
the J. Edgar Hoover movie was terrible.
I didn't watch that one.
The Jersey Boys is terrible.
Yeah, didn't watch that
one. And also, American Sniper was not good.
Did not see that one. I mean, I
sorry.
I Clint Eastwood means is it from a total.
The most recent one was good with about the 96 bombing at the Olympics.
Oh. I didn't see it because I just seems like I don't like the guy. And then I don't like the movies and everyone's accusing me of conservative bias. These are like my family members. Like his movies aren't that, I don't know.
Richard Jewell. That's the one.
Oh yeah.
With, what's his name? The lawyer, Lee is in that one.
So, according to, this is breaking news. And this isn't a huge surprise. Jamal Khashoggi was killed by a Saudi hit squad operating under the command of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Yep.
And Joe Biden had apparently put in a call to King Salman, who reportedly has Alzheimer's. I don't know what he said, but this is, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes.
I mean, he's no longer, negotiating with MBS, so, treating him as the de facto leader.
We'll see. I mean, it's, we will see. But interesting that this is released now, and we'll have more to say on it Monday. Buckaroo Samurai says, Emma Unforgiven is legit amazing. I got some bad news for you. If you want to see, and I don't know if he does this all the time, but if you want to see what actually is legit amazing, don't watch Unforgiven. I mean, you can watch it, but watch, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, Peckinpah movie. And, that is the better version of Unforgiven. But, all right, we got a lot of stuff we got to go through here because CPAC is happening, and this year it is.
Are we going the fun half or doing Freebie Friday?
We're doing Freebie Friday.
Okay.
We're doing
I don't have your stamina. I got to go take my break for like 2 minutes.
All right, Emma's going to step away for a moment. I'll read some IMs.
Okay.
While you awesome.
Union mandated.
There you go.
Exactly.
Drake from Wisconsin. Black Bear was awesome. Watched it twice. Recommended it to all my friends. Illuminati kids. Hard to believe we've had a whole year of already Sam not knowing who Aubrey Plaza is and then being informed she's from Parks and Rec. Jersey Max. Oh, that's right. Right? Because that probably came up when he went to the actual Yeah, to Sundance. Hey, folks, today we had a phone zap for Medicare for All run by the South Jersey DSA. Everything went well, but we need more people. Anybody interested can still look it up on the South Jersey DSA. Also, anyone in South Jersey should join the chapter if they want to. Left is best. Check it out, folks. Babe Alert. If the Senate won't overrule the parliamentarian, the Senate won't kill, amend the filibuster, how are we going to pass a $15 minimum wage in a standalone bill? I don't think that that is going to happen. I think, you know, we talked about what their plan B was. The Tim Caucus, from my perspective, I don't want people to forget this pandemic. I think it needs to stay in the public consciousness. I think it can be a motivation for change. Change might not happen, but I think the memory makes it more possible. I mean, I agree, but I also, I mean, I'm not going to forget it, but I don't know that people are going to make art about it. They probably will, but 10 long knowns. Sale of light trucks and cars dropped 35% from 07 to 09. They dropped 16% in 2020 alone. Without a robust stimulus package and other income inequality addressing measures like a raised minimum wage, there'll be more dominoes falling instead of a recovery. I don't know if you can make that apples to oranges 07-09 comparison, because I would imagine that part of the reason why sales for cars and trucks dropped 16% in 2020 is because people weren't going anywhere. I mean, I can tell you that people have told me that they think that there's more deer and animals in rural areas because there were so few people driving in the spring of last year that deer weren't being hit. And so I don't think you can look and say that the reason why sales of cars and trucks dropped, or that it's indicative of people not having the money to go out and buy it, although that may be the case. I think part of it was also people are like, why am I going to go buy a new car right now? I'm not even using my car right now.
We saw the air pollution go down significantly in the first half of, in the months following.
Teen Av, Black Bear, my favorite movie. Disco Stew, I already read that. Josh from Chicago, Wonder Woman 1984 was good. There I sent it. Tenet was great.
No, it wasn't. And Wonder Woman 1984 was not good. And it has it's like critics agree with me. It's like a 32% on Rotten Tomatoes.
My 15-year-old daughter was like,
it was
stunk.
I mean, I love the first one. Love. The first hour, it's a 3-hour movie. The first hour, there's no plot.
I think that's what Matthew's getting at as a matter of spectacle. Like, it doesn't matter if the movie is bad at this point, as long as you get everyone to watch it collectively.
Yeah, I mean, I want to see it because, you know, I love the first Wonder Woman, and, like, you know, I want to support the good superhero movies because, as established with Sam, there's a lot of filler out there.
The worst thing about sitting through an awful movie, says Quam, like Wonder Woman in the COVID era, is that you really, really don't have to. You could easily, you're home, you could easily change the channel.
I know, but I wanted to understand how bad it was.
That's Mr. Liberal, media liberal to you, Avid or Adobe Premiere? I'm trying to think. I think Matthew Film Guy uses Premiere. Milton Apathy, Cloud Atlas was good. What's his take on Sense8? I can't get into it. Maddie Moron, Cloud Atlas effing slaps. Insurrection, Ryan Gosling is my male crush. Bay. Hey, Sam, what about Infinity War? I hear it's utilitarian-esque type of film. My Border Collie, if we keep wearing masks in public places after COVID, we can still save lives by stopping the spread of a lot of other diseases. I imagine there's going to be, like, a lot of people are going to just choose to go out and wear masks for a long time, I would imagine. Christo, Black Bear is indeed quite good, Matthew, to see Nomadland. I wish I could have seen it in a theater for sure. I haven't seen that, but we interviewed the woman who wrote Nomadland.
Yes.
Right? And I can't even remember when we did that. Like 2016?
No, that was probably like 2019, honestly.
Oh, jeez.
I know.
What? Prairie Fire. Does Matthew have a review of Greenland? Kinch, Flatliners, Slaps. Also, okay. Back in the mid-2000s, when she was used as a punchline in Team America, Janine Garofalo said we were living in an era of neo-McCarthyism where public dissent leads to blacklisting. Was she right to characterize it that way? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you were legit blacklisted if you came out against the war. I mean, not, not, I would say neo-blacklist. Let's put it that way. But yes. Yes.
Brendan, what was the Netflix thing? Because I can't watch it, you know. But what was the Netflix thing that you sent in the Slack? I'm very curious about it.
It's a show called Ginny and Georgia. And I was pulling it as a highlight of, like, you know, spectacle and streaming.
Can you play it at some... Okay, can you play this? Sam, I want to see this. He sent it in the Slack, and it's just very much piqued my interest.
All right, let's do it, and then we'll...
Have you seen it?
No.
Oh, this is good. We're going in blind. Okay.
Yeah.
One, you don't get it. You are closer to white than I'll ever be.
Together, we make a whole white person.
Your favorite food is cheeseburgers, and I know more Mandarin than you do. You're barely even Asian.
Sorry, I'm not Chinese enough for you. But I've never seen you pound back jerk chicken. Last time I checked, Brody twerks better than you. And I liked your poem, but your bars could use a little more work, homie. So really, how black are you then?
Excuse me?
What? Literally, what? Because if we're going to play that game, let's do it. Oppression Olympics. Let's go.
Is that satire?
What is that?
That's a show on Netflix now for Milo's age, I guess.
Right, oh, right. Gosh. It seems like a teen show. So that's not a joke, right?
I don't think so, no.
It's supposed to pass as dialogue that two people have.
Wow. I was just like, wait, what?
All right, thanks for showing that.
Folks, I wonder if the CPAC is going to be like a little bit of a super spreader event.
Oh, yeah.
CPAC is taking place. This is the conservative, what is it called?
Political Action Conference. It's very confusing because PAC stands for obviously Political Action Committee.
Right.
Yeah.
They are in Orlando, Florida, of course. They have rented a hotel. And they have to remind everybody, like, this is how they have to cajole their people to wear masks. This is hilarious.
Effort at this CPAC to talk about the Bill of Rights. But I also want to mention one thing, and I know this might sound like a little bit of a downer, but we also believe in property rights, and this is a private hotel. And we believe in the rule of law, so we need to comply with the laws of this county that we're in. But a private hotel, just like your house, gets to set its own rules. Carly, our CPAC director.
Well, as Dan mentioned, we are in a private facility, and we do want to be respectful of the ordinances that they have as their private property. So please, everyone, when you're in the ballroom, when you're seated, you should still be wearing a mask. So if everybody can go ahead, work on that. I know it's not the most fun.
You have the right. You have the right to set the own rules in your own house, and we're borrowing somebody else's house. So we need to comply with their rules. So thank you all for putting on your masks. I wear a mask when I'm in the halls, and we're going to comply with their rules.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good conference.
You know, in that movie where Mel Gibson yells freedom, mm-hmm. You know what happens right after he yells that, right?
Bloodbath.
He gets physically gutted. Yeah. They actually pull his intestines out.
It really is an apt comparison for them. Yeah, it's like they smear paint on their face, red paint in this instance, not blue like Mel Gibson in Braveheart, because obviously Democrats. And then take off their mask, get infected, and just die on the spot.
Right. I mean, I don't know which I like more. The idea that these guys are not respecting private property rights. Mm. Or, I want them to just sort of like at that point, just all purposely breathe into each other's mouths as a way of just showing how they're not going to.
Everyone kiss.
I mean, it really is amazing. It's like a bunch of children, right?
Yeah, well,
I mean,
it's like, look at how they have to frame it to them. It's like private property.
I like how the guy also dishes it off to,
Yes.
I've got something very bad to tell you, Emma. you gotta wear your mask.
Please,
scapegoat young woman.
Yeah, I know. As she clutches the mic with both hands in fear, as they scream freedom at her, the mob. It's like, yeah, you gotta. It's like probably like what you have to do with your kids, Sam. You have to tell them something unpleasant, so you couch it in things that they can understand.
Like, I honestly, that is more childish than anything I've ever had to do for my 7-year-old. So the House passed the Equality Act. They've passed it in the past. It has died in the Senate. It very well may. I don't know if it's going to die in the Senate this time, but it's. I don't know that it will pass in the Senate. But this is basically an extension or an amendment, if you will, to federal civil rights laws that would provide protections for LGBTQ Americans in employment, in education, in housing, in credit, jury service, and other areas. Many people do not realize this. In 27 states across the country right now, you can be denied the ability to rent an apartment because you are gay, because you are trans. You can be denied education in 31 states. You can be denied the right to serve on a jury in 41 states. Just based on the fact that, like, you're gay, mm-hmm. that you're transgender. It is, I just don't think that people fully are aware of this. You can be denied employment because you're gay. And so the House passed this, and it is, of course, you know, an opportunity. At the same time, I guess this Mr. Potato Head. I mean, it's like, you know, this is such a this is what we're going to get from the
conservative. Up that Mondaire Jones thing, but
no. let's listen to Mondaire Jones. Just I didn't realize we had that clip. Yeah,
yeah.
Here's Mondaire Jones. This guy is
he's the first black gay representative, I believe, in or openly maybe. Yeah. In the House, and he's a real progressive from New York.
And he won it was an open primary because I believe when he first got into the race, and I cannot remember who the incumbent was.
Nita Lowry.
Yeah.
Lowry.
She was going to run against, and then I think she saw the writing on the wall. She stepped down, did not run again. It was an open primary. There was a couple of progressives in it, and there was a couple of not-so-progressives. And the progressives coalesced around Mondaire.
Including, you know, in that race, there was a son of a hedge fund, either billionaire or multi-multi-millionaire, who outspent Mondaire Jones significantly, and Mondaire Jones still came out on top as a progressive candidate in the race.
And here he is speaking on the House floor in support of this bill.
Mr. Speaker, it is not often that this chamber does remarkable things. Today, we passed the Equality Act, which includes my bill, the Juror Non-Discrimination Act. This has been a long time coming, and it represents progress that, for me, was unbelievable when I was growing up. You see, to grow up poor, black, and gay is to not see yourself anywhere. It is also to feel completely unseen, as so many people around you invalidate your very existence. Growing up, I watched helplessly as opportunistic, straight politicians, mostly white, mostly male, used my basic human rights as a political football to further their careers. Had this legislation been enacted when I was growing up, it would have been direct evidence of the fact that things really do get better, that I didn't have to hide or cry so much. Thankfully, since childhood, things have gotten better. But that hasn't been because of the mere passage of time. It's been because LGBTQ advocates made life better. Today, we send a powerful message to millions of LGBTQ people around the country and indeed around the world that they are seen, that they are valued, that their lives are worthy of being protected. How remarkable that is, Mr.
I thought that was very powerful.
It's very powerful. And the implications, I don't know if it's going to pass in the Senate. I would hope it would, but I don't know that it's going to, because in this instance, you would probably need unless there ends up being some type of filibuster reform. But again, it does signal to millions of kids. I mean, other people too, but kids that, like, you know, you're not some type of freak, that there is some measure of acceptance in society, that there is a significant portion of society, a majority, that says that you are a human being, you have the same sort of rights as anyone else. And
a reminder that, I mean, it must have been around 10 years ago that Joe Biden leapfrogged Obama on gay marriage, coming out in favor of it. But, like, how short of a time ago that was. And I should correct myself, by the way. Mondair Jones and Richie Torres both came into Congress at the same time, the two first black male gay representatives. So they came in at once. But the progress on this issue has been exponential, and yet we're still seeing in the Senate chambers yesterday open anti-trans, transphobic comments by someone like Rand Paul, who, to the nominee's face, her name's escaping me, but she's a trans woman, said that it was equivalent to female genital mutilation, what she's gone through. And so you have this contrast. So there's no equivocating. There's no false equivalences when it comes to Rachel Levine is her name. When it comes to the two parties on this, there's one party that represents hate, and then there's another party that is inclusive and doesn't just have voices like Mondaire Jones speaking out about this, but they have legislation to back it up. Then there's also the Mr. Potato Head controversy.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Let's go to the Mr. Potato Head controversy. It's no longer Mr. Potato Head. But wait, one second. I want to read a couple IMs here. Matthew Film Guy, I totally blanked, but I remember now I did see The New Host, the Zoom horror film. I thought it was great. The latest in a long line of found footage type films, which I've always appreciated. And it was pretty scary, too. Nikki 1215, I've been listening for 5 years. I'm from Philly, still here. Just wanted to say the back and forth that Nomi Key and Emma had about Fetterman shows Emma's blindness to race. Just because he likes weed does not mean he's progressive, and some people do change their views, but don't make it like it won't be a huge issue, because there's definitely something there in that incident. Also,
no, I think he's the most progressive candidate currently in the race, and I'm going to support that person despite past incidents, especially because I think he has a good chance to win in the Senate. I think that is an unfair characterization, 100%.
Also, there'll be a lot of people in this race, and I wouldn't be so sure to throw my support into him. I believe Kenyatta will make more noise just because he's more likable to centrists. I'm not a fan of his, but just saying.
Well, I think Fetterman's going to be fairly acceptable to centrists as well. It'll be an open primary, but I'm not throwing out somebody based on one incident, and I don't think that is a fair characterization of my position.
Somebody this is very smart. Brendan just sent me this. Just the tweets, President Trump's historical collection of all his tweets. That is a brilliant.
Oh, that's amazing.
Marketing book. I mean, I will here put that.
I'll want that. Yeah.
You know, we'll have a better sense of the Fetterman stuff as we.
I mean, Kenyatta's not more progressive than Fetterman in terms of his position, so that's really all I care about.
Lawyer adjacent, thoughts on Greenwald bemoaning how there are more trans people today than 20 years ago, indistinguishable from every other. Did he say that? I would need to see the context of that. I'd be surprised. If you're lamenting that, like, I don't know, there's also, more gay people who come out of the closet because, I mean, I need to see that. All right, so Speaking of which, there's a massive controversy that is brewing on the right that, of course, when, you know, at the end of the Obama era, like, how are we going to move forward? Well, it's going to be about the idea of trans people using bathrooms, which the amount of time that was spent on that as an issue is extraordinary.
And it paid off, right? Because that's still such a massive issue in society.
I think what happened was at one point, and you mentioned that Joe Biden, you know, sort of leapfrogged Obama when it came to marriage equality. And I don't know if we know the full story of exactly how that came about. I remember being at a Netroots conference and having a meeting with Obama back in 2008 when he was running in the primary. And there was about 10 of us in there, and he had been asked about marriage equality, and he basically said that, you know, strategically, he didn't think it made sense to pursue that first, you know, as opposed to other rights for gay people. And I think he uses an example like, I think I wouldn't, you know, before the Voting Rights Act, I wouldn't have necessarily pursued anti-miscegenation laws. I'm not sure. I can't remember that exactly. But the point is that, you know, he was basically saying, like, I don't have the political capital to come out in favor of it. And I don't know whether or not he you know, that was sincere or not. But 3 years earlier, you had George W. Bush in a primetime address to the country announced that he was in favor of a constitutional amendment. It was 2004 to amend the Constitution to prevent gay people from getting married.
Yep.
And I mean, it is really contemplate the idea of writing into the Constitution a specific provision to deny, and it really doesn't matter the number of people, but a cohort of people a right that we offer to other people in this country. And all the rights that come, there's something, I don't know, 1,200, 1,400 rights that are associated with marriage. I remember that night. It was one of the most terrifying. I found it really terrifying. Very chilling, maybe, is the real word I'm looking at. Because it was, you could see how these type of things happen in that moment. I regretfully need to come out in support of this constitutional amendment. I mean, and so our society in that regard has moved very quickly. And I think for the right, they no longer, I mean, I don't know if people appreciate what I'm saying here. Like 15 years ago, 16, 17 years ago, the idea of marriage equality was so, like, literally they would say in the next breath, this is like cats and dogs are going to rain from the sky if we do this.
Oh, what's going to happen? Are people going to be able to marry animals next?
Animals, the institution of marriage is going to, and all of that is gone. Like, I mean, you hear about it in small pockets, but in mainstream, I mean, this was so mainstream. The president was on primetime television talking about it, full-throated, not even in a press conference. This is like, these are prepared statements. And so the right knows that, like, we can't mobilize our voters. And they did this in 2004. They deployed a bunch of state constitutional amendment referendums to get their voters out. They really milked it. And it's not available to them anymore. So they just move on to the next thing, which is, well, the real threat to society are trans people who are going to blow up our notion of, you know, men are men and women are women. And how do we see this permeating our society? Dave Rubin's going to tell you. He's going to tell you because it is actually like seeped into an icon of our childhood.
This is how they're trying to get our kids.
Mr. Potato Head.
No, Sam, how dare you? You're canceled. It's Potato Head.
Is now Potato Head.
Yeah. Can't even say it.
This is just insanity. It ain't going to stop. It's just coming at every level. The other one that I saw this morning is that Hasbro has announced that Mr. Potato Head won't be called Mr. Potato Head anymore. He'll just be Potato Head because obviously that was offensive to somebody, or he wasn't really a man, or he is a man, or being a man. You could take the mustache off, then he's Mrs. Potato Head. I mean, did you watch Toy Story? There was Mr. Potato Head and Mrs. Potato Head, and you can switch all their... We live literally in the dumbest time.
Wait a second! Oh, my God!
He figured it out!
He figured out, like, wait a second.
His brain caught up to his mouth.
There couldn't be a more gender and occupationally fluid toy that has ever existed than Potato Head in the history of toys. It's literally, you got a potato and
some holes,
and then some holes, and you can just make it a different gender, a non-specific gender, a non-specific occupation. I mean, and he discovers it in the middle of his diatribe. I mean, how absolutely outrageous it is. You know what's ridiculous? How pathetic it was they had to call it Mr. Potato Head, as opposed to just Potato Head in the first place.
But Sam, this is what is happening. Hasbro, obviously, big globalist Hasbro, as maybe Dave Rubin or the rest of the right would say, they're encouraging kids. Maybe the kid will put the woman's hair on and then like a tie. That's mixing genders. How will you know if it's Mr. or Mrs. Potato Head?
I mean, that's who knows what is it going to be next? G.I. Jane? Oh, I think we have that.
Yeah. And then what's next? The continent blows up.
Is there any more to Dave Rubin? Is he just basically trying to wrap things up after he realizes, like, oh, I just proved the point as to why calling it Potato Head's not that big of a deal.
Or he is a man, or being a man. You could take the mustache off, then he's Mrs. Potato Head. I mean, did you watch Toy Story? There was Mr. Potato and Mrs. Potato Head, and you can switch all their...
Oops.
We live literally in the dumbest time in human history. And there's something to be said for that. You know what I mean? Like, if you can keep your sense of humor and not go completely bananas and all that, there is absolutely something to be said.
Yeah.
Dave's sense of humor is very good. I've seen his stand-up comedy.
Oh, well, you know what else proves that we're living in one of the dumbest times in human history? That guy. Making millions.
To talk about.
Talk about Mr. Potato Head being like the biggest outrage in the world. There's no Mr. anymore on the Potato Head.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's amazing. Like, you know, he's got to do this because he's on Glenn Beck's network. And deep down, he's got to know at one point he's going to have to account for the fact that he is married to a man when everyone on that network has a problem with the institution of marriage for gay people. And on some level, I have some sympathy for him because he's got to live in some measure of fear every day that somebody at one point is going to make enough of an issue for that, that it inhibits his ability to be on that network.
I would not say I have sympathy. You know, you'd be very sad if he wasn't able to grift anymore. Like, I mean, it's like, this is the bed he's made for himself based on unresolved self-loathing. I'll say that.
Yeah. I mean, maybe.
Sorry.
I don't know. Maybe I'm getting a little soft in my old age. But that is just impressive. And, oh, is it just Dave Rubin who's upset about Mr. Potato Head? No. This is a movement now that the conservatives have embraced. The outrage. That is no longer Mr.
You've got to stop saying Mr. because it's actually offensive.
Well, I said no longer Mr. Nay. Here is Ainsley Earhart. She's worried about this as well.
Charlie, though, if I wanted to buy one, and let's say I had the boy at home and I wanted the girl.
And the money.
The box is going to say Potato Head. How am I going to know which one I'm getting?
Exactly.
Well, because it also, because the main logo is now Potato Head.
Right.
Okay. But
in little writing on the bottom, it still says Mr. and Mrs. Okay. Potato Head. So yeah. You know which one you're getting.
So, Carly, doesn't this sound like somebody said something to that publication Fast Company that the company was not anticipating the backlash, and the backlash was enormous, and then they tried, they brought in the lawyers and everybody else and said, okay, how do we dig ourselves out of this potato hole?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Right. Also, I gotta point out, it's the ultimate genderless toy already. First of all, it's a potato, and it has those little interchangeable parts, so
potatoes
you can make it whatever
have no
you want.
Gender.
Yeah, then why do you give a shit? Why do you care? And you can tell the difference. Problem solved. Ainsley's like, how will I know if I'm getting Mr. or Mrs.? Oh, it's just in smaller font.
Right. I mean, how will I know if I'm getting the chef or the construction worker? Or how am I going to know if I'm getting the, you know, whatever it is, the cop or the fireman?
And honestly, it's just a two for one. Because now there's no gender. Now the real victims in this.
I'm confused. Potato Head. I'm walking around like, well, which one am I going to get? I don't know.
No, you'll get both parts. Hasbro, they're the ones that are going to really lose half their profits here because now they have to be combined into one because they can't sell Mr. and Mrs. to go together unless they do maybe do a value pack and then they can be just the married potatoes. And then you're all, problem solved. But, you know, I think Ainsley Earhart, you know, I know that she goes.
How am I going to get the...
Ainsley spends her days, you know, at whatever's left of these Toys R Us's, wandering, looking for Mr. Potato Heads. I mean, like, that's kind of her, life, right?
I'm so confused by Potato Head. Unbelievable.
I love the idea of her purchasing, in what scenario, Ainsley, are you in the market for a Potato Head doll? Like, are you? What kind of freaky stuff are you doing with Sean?
Well, yeah, I'm going to have to, maybe we could start a business being a Potato Head consultant. Like, if you can't figure out which Potato Head you want, hire me. I will help you. Final IM of the week, which is not actually the final IM of the week. Hey, I'm our crew. I've been watching the show for years, but my disappointment is unmeasurable. I recently bought a mug on your store. I was really looking forward to wrapping your show on Zoom meetings and all. Unfortunately, I cannot use the mug because the handle is too small for my hands. I've never been told my hands are too big. Could I get a refund? So sad. I'm thinking of creating a support group with the caller from Puerto Rico. Stop the steal. MR merch don't fit. Left is best.
Is this Trump? Trump?
No.
Talking about his big hands?
This is a response to somebody, I think, the other day who said
it
was too big. It goes on. I mean, it's like this is what the right is going to spend their time talking about and trying to make a boogie person out of any trans person that they can come across in any context.
Or trans potato.
Or trans potato or whatever it is. And, you know, there's serious cost to this. You have every week, nearly, sometimes more, we have a trans person killed because of transphobia. And here is Rand Paul just going all in. You mentioned this earlier, Rachel Levine, she is nominated for Assistant Secretary of Health. She would be the first trans woman nominated, I believe, for a Senate confirmed position or confirmed for a Senate, both nominated and confirmed from a Senate confirmed position. This is clip number 13.
Senator Paul.
Genital mutilation has been nearly universally condemned. Genital mutilation has been condemned by the WHO, the United Nations Children's Fund, the United Nations Population Fund. According to the WHO, genital mutilation is recognized internationally as a violation of human rights. Genital mutilation is considered particularly egregious because, as the WHO notes, it is nearly always carried out on minors and is a violation of the rights of children. Most genital mutilation is not typically performed by force, but as WHO notes, that by social convention, social norm, the social pressure to conform, to do what others do and have been doing, as well as the need to be accepted socially and the fear of being rejected by the community. American culture is now normalizing the idea that minors can be given...
Pause for 1 second. Let's be clear what he's doing. He's comparing genital mutilation to surgery to transition. Now, let's also be clear that the vast majority of any type of surgery that takes place does not happen on anybody, and everybody signs up for it instantly after an extensive period of time until someone's 18 years old. They do not do it to conform to society standards.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's just, but he's got to make this turn now in his talk that somehow now what's actually happening in society, according to Rand Paul, is there is social pressure to transition.
It's the transition opposite.
Surgery. Of course.
It's the opposite.
It's not even remotely close.
And of course, goes in hot. He starts with the words genital mutilation and then keeps repeating it.
So just go back a little bit in this clip, just so that people understand what this guy is trying to do, like how bat crap crazy it is.
Yeah. And just cruel.
And offensive.
To do what others do and have been doing, as well as the need to be accepted socially and the fear of being rejected by the community. American culture is now normalizing the idea that minors can be given hormones to prevent their biological development of their secondary sexual characteristics. Dr. Levine, you have supported both allowing minors to be given hormone blockers to prevent them from going through puberty, as well as surgical destruction of a minor's genitalia. Like surgical mutilation, hormonal interruption of puberty can permanently alter and prevent secondary sexual characteristics. The American College of Pediatricians reports that 80 to 95% of prepubertal children with gender dysphoria will experience resolution by late adolescence if not exposed to medical intervention and social affirmation. Dr. Levine, do you believe that minors are capable of making such a life-changing decision as changing one's sex?
Well, Senator, thank you for your interest in this question. Transgender medicine is a very complex and nuanced field with robust.
Oh, I'd like to hear her answer.
I mean, the fact that she didn't leap across the Senate desk and grab that little twerp is a miracle in and of itself.
Right. I mean, I think the proper answer to that is, boy, you're an asshole. But buckle up, because this is going to be like a regular talking point that you're going to hear from the right for an extended period of time. Here's some of her answer.
Interest in this question. Transgender medicine is a very complex and nuanced field with robust research and standards of care that have been developed. And if I am fortunate enough to be confirmed as the Assistant Secretary of Health, I would look forward to working with you and your office and coming to your office and discussing the particulars of the standards of care for transgender medicine.
The specific question was about minors. Let's be a little more specific since you evaded the question. Do you support the government intervening to override the parent's consent to give a child puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and/or amputation surgery of breasts and genitalia? You have said that you're willing to accelerate the protocols for street kids. I'm alarmed that poor kids with no parents who are homeless and distraught, you would just go through this and allow that to happen to a minor. I would hope that you would have compassion.
1 second. So he's, even in the context of his own question, will you allow the government to overrule the parents? And then he just pivots to, well, what about kids who have no parents?
What situation could homeless kids afford this surgery, by the way? It's just, like, ridiculous.
Well, but even in the context of if we have the government providing and subsidizing this type of health care for children
who are homeless,
who are in some fashion emancipated, he wants to make this about the government coming in and preventing parents from having a say over children that are minors. And this is just not happening. This is just not happening. And they need to do this to scare people in the same way that they were scaring people 20 years ago, that if you allow two men or two women to marry, they're going to, you know, want to have kids and they're going to molest them. I mean, this is the same type of stuff that we were hearing 20 years ago about gay people. And now they don't have the same political salience that it had then. So they move on to another area where their constituencies who are ignorant to these things will believe all sorts of like lies and fears. And really in the final analysis, again, it is really about their fear. And there's so much of the right politics that are that ultimately get down to the idea of like emancipation for women, some type of destruction of the patriarchy. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. And
that's really what the fear of gender is rooted in, is really just like the mixing of, or the
how are we supposed to know who's supposed to stay in the kitchen?
Yeah, the muddling of gender roles, and you know, trans people have broken their brains so much because it makes them confront the fluidity of gender, and perhaps the fact that they've been taught such static, rigid roles, that it's not right and that it's not even natural. It's actually the opposite of what they were taught was natural, and that makes Rand Paul very scared.
All right, people are asking me to Google. Will somebody send me the tweet that Greenwald did? I'm not dodging it. I just didn't see it.
Wait, which one?
All right, somebody sent it to me. Hold on one second. In the meantime, everybody's getting into the act. Here is Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm sure everybody has seen that the video.
We covered it yesterday.
Oh, you did. Okay. Of her putting up her sign to you know, across the hall from
Marie Newman, because she has a trans child, because, you know, it's like, it's great office culture.
Here is a Marjorie Taylor Greene on the House floor claiming that she was victimized by the January 6th insurrection that she encouraged, incidentally. And the
that
Equality Act
was a part of, by the way.
What's that?
It's like one of her friends.
Oh, yes.
The insurrectionists.
The Equality Act is, in her mind, it is a plot. It's a plot against religious people.
I'd like to point out to my Democrat colleagues that there is no Republican member of Congress that condones the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. I was also a victim in this chamber when it happened, and we are very offended at your constant attacks on us for claiming we had anything to do with it. So that needs to stop. I'd also like to address the entire 117th Congress and say that the Equality Act is not about stopping discrimination. It's about causing discrimination against women and religious freedoms. I would like to motion to adjourn, Madam Speaker.
What are you? It's like, you don't have any power. You're not on any committees. What are you there for? You're there to put up signs. You're there to make speeches, perform aggrievement. Play me the smallest violin ever.
The whole Republican agenda, basically, at this point.
No, I get it.
You just said she's the perfect Republican.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, look, but she's got no power. She's a joke.
She is a bit of a joke, except for the fact that she is a clear window into the constituency of the Republican Party. I mean, that is the relevance of Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, you could take any of those other 200 some odd Republican congresspeople and you could send them out to a, you know, whatever it is, civic center, and say they're going to have a talk, and she is going to draw as much, if not more, than any of those other congresspeople. She has no power. She's not even on a committee. But she is like your next iteration of your Michelle Bachmann, of your Sarah Palin, of your, you know, we'll see how she evolves, if she'll be a Steve King. But she is that, I mean, she is capturing the essence of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Let's play this clip of Amazon. They are very concerned. They're spending up to $25 million to stop their warehouse workers in Alabama from unionizing. And here's the interesting thing about this, is that because of the Supreme Court ruling in the, I think it was the Janus case, it was two, there was Friedrich and Janus, but it ended up being Janus. The Janus case, where the Supreme Court ruled that even if you have a union in your workplace and they are negotiating on your behalf and they raise your wages, you are not obligated to pay union dues. That was the case prior to Janus. You're not even obligated to pay what is known as an agency fee, to pay them to provide any funding for their hiring of lawyers and doing negotiations and providing like an opportunity if you have a workplace grievance, or to adjudicate any of that, or to report any of it, to log it, to represent it to management. None of that. So you have a lot of you have a lot of workers who are like, why wouldn't I vote for the union? Well, because Amazon's going to spend $25 million to explain that to you. Here is an ad that they have deployed on Twitch.
We at the Birmingham team have a great leadership. We really don't need anyone coming in and telling us what they want to give us, because basically we have everything we need here. Always wanted to work for Amazon. This is the only place I've seen that have benefits from day one. There's no waiting period. You got chances to advance.
Vote no for the union.
I will vote no.
It's not needed.
Vote no, we can do it without the dues.
Unreal. I mean, and also based on some, you know, I talked about this on Ring of Fire. We did an interview. There's just like all of these tactics that they're using are insane. I mean, they have, it's technically illegal, but it's not really enforced. The workplace intimidation from joining the union. There's flyers all over the bathroom stalls put up by Amazon. They are hosting captive audience meetings with members of their workforce in order to discourage them from being a union. And the Verge reported, and it was verified by county police, I believe, they were changing the stoplight times in order to, because Amazon can do whatever it wants on their premises in order to intimidate their workers from not joining the union. But because of laws, the union cannot solicit and canvass on Amazon premises. So what the union was doing was outside of the facility, they were stopping workers and giving them flyers about the union outside the traffic lights.
They were not stopping. They were handing flyers out when the workers were stopped at a traffic light.
That's what I meant to say. Yes. And then what Amazon did was they changed the timing, so in order to thwart that canvassing effort,
so that the red light wouldn't exist as long, so that they couldn't hand out the information.
Yeah.
Jacob from Alabama, IMs, would be interested in calling in about Amazon and Joe Biden not endorsing the campaign. 256 area code. We're not taking calls today, but we will do that. We're wrapping up in just a second.
Yeah.
Mayor,
but Bernie and Ilhan Omar and other great progressives endorsed it and did a video for More Perfect Union, which was a good new media operation started by former Bernie staffers as well.
The mayor of Birmingham also refused to endorse initially, but caved under local union pressure. The union the workers are seeking to be represented was the only union to endorse Woodfin in his primary challenge. So there is time to collect, essentially, is what's going on in terms of that. Let's see. Oh, this one's pretty good, too. Let's just do this, and then we'll get out of here. This is from CPAC, because we're going to have a lot to talk about on CPAC.
So much CPAC on Monday.
Does anybody know anything about this guy, Genki Fuji?
Most of the stuff I found was in Japanese and, like, poorly, you know, Google translated. But he's a conservative from Japan who, I think, from what I can judge, has some opinions on feminism.
And also, I mean, I wonder, like, this is all about, like, the cash, right? Like, I mean, like, how does a Japanese conservative pundit think they're going to make money?
Yeah, he turned his involuntary celibacy into becoming a MAGA head.
Is that right?
I don't know. I'm just assuming, based on his stances.
Well, I don't know. He's here he is, Genki Fuji, and they played this video, and I wonder, I imagine he paid for it, right? I mean, that's the way that something like this works, or is he just come? I mean, I don't know if he's there in person and they bring him in as a speaker. But...
Well, I mean, it's like he figured it's like he can invest here and then it'll pay dividends by the cult members buying his stuff.
Now, he is he's showing that he's got samurai skills, so he can be a little bit intimidating. Yeah.
Samurai is right back. Aloha American conservatives. I'm a Japanese journalist and an author of more than 70 books on international relations.
Pause it for 1 second. This is just, no, keep the picture up there. No, cut to me. Keep the picture up there because he's the author of more than 70 books. And is he written about Trump or does he just have Trump's book up there?
Well, I mean, they see Trump book and then the brains go, I might buy your book.
The best is too, is, you know, because it's rare that we play a video of somebody who's older than me. Watch this guy, like this samurai, walk down the stairs. This is my favorite part. He walks down the stairs so tentatively. It's like Donald Trump walking down the stairs. Here, play this.
I run online World Forecast News Service. I respect President Trump and American conservatives. President Trump fought against Chinese communists in order to protect the entire free world. President Trump, he's a real American samurai. I want to make US-Japan alliance stronger. I want to build solid friendship with real American patriots or American samurai. Let's fight together for freedom. Let's slash the cancel culture. Let's start US Japan Samurai to Samurai Alliance.
He's a samurai futurologist? Is that what it is?
I guess. And for $29.99, you can hear more about how you can become an American samurai.
I'm going
to watch that Tom Cruise movie, The Last Samurai. You can know all you need to know.
Stab cancel culture with a sword.
Yeah. I would love to. I really would let Trump try to swing a sword, though. That would be a pretty fun exercise, just in terms of watching him exercise. I can't wait for Trump's speech. By the way, at CPAC,
it's going to be pretty
fun.
I gotta
tell you, miss that guy.
All right, so people sent me this Glenn Greenwald tweet, which turns out to be a series of like 5 or 6 tweets.
Yeah, he cited a transphobic.
But what is the I mean, I'll read it obviously another time, but I can't read it now.
The rest of it is he took this Gallup data, kind of misrepresented it in order to maybe allude to the fact that like more lesbians are becoming trans men instead. It's just like not true. A lot of people refuted it. Like the data is interesting in and of itself, but the way that he interpreted it is just like another, I think, bad faith take of his, which they seem to be, or not even bad faith, but just bad take of his that seem to be increasing in frequency recently. So yeah, he cited Katie Herzog, who a lot of people think is a transphobic lesbian writer. People use the word TERF.
He's arguing that the massive increase in Americans self-identifying as LGBT, an increase due to overwhelmingly more bi and trans self-identifiers, is partially a function of increased societal acceptance. But that's clearly not the only factor, and I doubt it's the primary one. So I'm not exactly sure what
the controversy is when it gets to the fourth tweet in there where it says, as famed lesbian Herzog notes, there are now among millennials and Gen Z more people identifying as trans and lesbian. She has previously argued that masculine girls are now encouraged to identify as trans, causing a decrease in the lesbian population. Many people pointed out that that data does not support that, based on he seems to have mixed up his numbers there, and that the numbers actually contradict what he's saying there. But basically, it's just like, I don't really understand how you can draw that conclusion. Yeah, more young people are willing to identify as trans, as gay, as bi, and as all of these different identifiers. I mean, the thing that I would think would be increasing would be, you know, bisexuality or non-binary sexuality, because I think the younger generation, this is a good thing, are way more fluid in the way that they express their gender and their gender identity. And so I don't understand what he's trying to glean from this.
I guess my sense of this, I mean, I got to read this more, and I'm not quite sure what the point is here. I'm not even sure, like, if, I mean, aside from my first response, from what I understand, is like, so what? But it's not like the idea that this is anything but social constraints dropping, so people feel more comfortable expressing who they are and have the ability to get a better sense of who they are, because there isn't the same cost that society is exacting from them for doing so. So what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again,
I just don't understand, like, what the, if
There's this conflict between, like, white feminists like J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter fame, for example, Sam, who are basically kind of fairly anti-trans because they think that transitioning from female to male, this was J.K. Rowling's argument, delegitimizes in some way the trauma that women have felt, which is an incredibly, like, narcissistic argument. And, it's nonsense. It's just accept everybody and allow people to have the freedom to identify in whatever they want. It's really, like, not that hard.
Very strange. Very strange. I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, exploring these questions and saying, like, you know, what is this phenomena that's going on seems to me to be perfectly fine. But to suggest, and I don't know that he's suggesting, I haven't even read these things, but I mean, the idea that, like, there's anything, like, sort of nefarious going on or disingenuous,
yeah,
or that society is sort of like,
or if there's anything dangerous about it, I think that's what the implication is that, you know, we should be like encouraging gayness as opposed to transness, like, it's just, who cares?
And particularly if, which, you know, I think that I would think ultimately my guess is that we're going to find that there is, like, sort of like a continuum. There's no, it's not like a, you know, a binary thing. I'm gay, I'm not gay. That different people have, you know, sort of like we're on a continuum.
Sexuality and gender can be a continuum. It doesn't need to be either or to other people.
And if it is the case that it is a continuum as opposed to, like, a light switch, then of course at different times where society has less obstacles to sort of being able to explore where you are on that continuum, or unless sort of like punishment for declaring where you are on that continuum. That's going to ebb and flow over time, of course. I mean, and that's, I don't think there's anything sort of nefarious about that. That is like, you know, sort of like the, and there may be social currency that is felt among certain generations or certain cohorts that's associated with identifying that way, that one would, you know, quite obviously expect as there is an attempt to emancipate people. And I mean, that just seems to me to be so both obvious and non-problematic. I don't know. That's, you know, and that's not, it's not to be confused with the idea that, like, you know, something is a choice or not a choice. Sometimes, like, you know, we just don't necessarily have the completely binary insights into who we are as people. And that changes as we get older. And that also changes relative to what's going on in society. I just don't understand the stakes that are associated with this. But we'll see. All right, folks.
Like the stream.
Like the stream. And let me read two more IMs and then we'll get out of here. Nikki in Astoria, as a New Yorker, I actually bought a car for the first time this year. Bob Dork. Wonder Woman 1984 has a 59% critic score and a 74% score in Rotten Tomatoes. Emma, sick of your lies.
It does? No way.
Dave Rubin dating profile. Joel Schumacher's A Time to Kill was really good. Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn it all. Final. Oh, I did that one already. Ryan Amok. Love the Outlaw Josie Wales, best Clint Eastwood directed movie. That is actually a pretty good movie. I would agree
with
that.
Which one?
Outlaw Josie Wales. Dying ain't no living, boy. That's just a...
Is it directed by him? I'm not saying movies he stars in.
I think that was directed by him. Penelope, I'm so old, I remember when you had to use a real potato. The plastic one wasn't included. You just bought a box of pieces. There you go. And the final IM of the day... Lawyer adjacent, worth remembering in light of Rand Paul talking about medicine that he was such a shitty optometrist he had to start his own board to license himself, which was somehow enough of the very serious state of Kentucky to allow him to practice medicine. Brendan, Kyle, Emma, Jamie, Matt's on vacation. Good job this week, guys. See you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth.